Excuse me, Mr. Speaker. Good morning. To all, and apologies for arriving a few moments late to this chamber. Technology doesn't always cooperate with those who rely on it. But Mr. Speaker, this has been a historic debate on the appropriation bill in many ways. The numbers reflect historic achievements for our community. They demonstrate an economic performance which is the envy of any other European nation. Indeed, if we're not to compare ourselves with larger economies, which would not be fair, even of emerging nations and smaller economies. And as I have said from the beginning, that is not because this chief minister is able to produce an estimate of 1.8 billion of GDP, or because this ministerial team is able to do it. This is the fruit of the work of everyone in our economy, and we do not claim credit for it. I have the honor and distinction of being allowed to get up in this place and announce those results to the nation and to the world, but this is not my work. I'm not going to do what others have done before me, not Mr. Buscannon. It is to come here and pretend that they, one individual, are responsible for holding the reins in such a manner that they are the ones who must forever be thanked for that grace. That is not true. And it would be a pretense to do that. I stand here as the lightning rod, Mr. Speaker, of the work of every economic actor in our community, announcing what they have achieved, not claiming the credit for having done the hours of hard work that are reflected in the numbers that we are announcing during the course of this debate. And, Mr. Speaker, one of the things I want to do this year in the course of my reply is that I will not only be responding to the speeches of honourable members opposite, I want to also reflect to the community some of the things that members on this side of the House have done and the work that they have been embarked on for the past 3.5 years. My first point of substance, Mr. Speaker, must of course be perhaps a little bit out of the tradition in this reply. Instead of speaking denigrating, Mr. Speaker, I want to start by congratulating the Leader of the Opposition for his contribution this year. I think, certainly from the point of view of those of us on this side, from the point of view of those of us who are going to take him on in the general election, I want to congratulate him for having pitched it absolutely perfectly from the point of view of those of us on this side. He was real, he was hyperbolic, he was everything except the statesman that Mr. Buscannon was yesterday evening, but he wouldn't know about that because he wasn't here to hear him. And he was absolutely right, Mr. Speaker. Let me be clear in my position. The Leader of the Opposition was absolutely right, Mr. Speaker, when he said that politics is about trust. Absolutely right. And the next election will be about trust. And about, not big, Mr. Speaker, huge lies. Huge lies told to the people of Gibraltar. So, Mr. Speaker, this debate also has been turned into a debate about trust. And that's where I want to go first. Because even in the course of his reply, he was dealing with the issue of liquefied natural gas and the safety of LNG as a fuel for bunkering and for power generation and for storage of that fuel, Mr. Speaker. So trust is particularly opposite a quality to be talking about. In particular, after another historic element of this debate this year, which is the government's move to suspend standing orders halfway through the debate to make a government statement, to make an announcement about Lord Register making an announcement themselves, which, as I will show in a few moments, demonstrated that everything we had heard peddled for the past 2 weeks about the Lord Register report was actually the furthest possible from the truth that one could imagine. But in that respect, Mr. Speaker, it's such a visible about Saturday and June. One of the things I want to start with is to reflect, Mr. Speaker, on how we respond to each other on the substance of issues in this debate and in every debate. And parliamentary etiquette, Mr. Speaker, and the way that the traditions of this parliament are honoured or dishonoured by specific members. And Mr. Speaker, the leader of the opposition breached parliamentary etiquette in the most incredible way in the past 24 hours. He spent most of this debate, Mr. Speaker, out of this chamber. And Mr. Speaker, it's normal for members who are dealing with work to be in and out of this chamber. But in the history of public debate in this House, as a mark of respect for the debate and for each other, the Leader of the Opposition and the Chief Minister, the Leader of the House, have sat through and heard every single contribution ever made during the course of this debate. Because we are the ones leading the respective teams that will have to answer and have an overview over all of the issues in politics. Yesterday I had to adjourn, Mr. Speaker, because I had urgent business after making the statement in the House, which I will come to a little bit later. In order not to deal with the failure, the disrespect of him making his speech, which I'm going to reply to, and not being here to hear it. I could simply, Mr. Speaker, have said, I have urgent government business, and Mr. Reyes will provide me with a note of the speech, or one of my colleagues who is being shadowed by Mr. Reyes will give me the feedback of the things I have to reply to. As it turns out, there's very little to reply to. But, Mr. Speaker, I adjourned the House in order to be here to do Mr. Reyes the respect of listening to him, even if he had got up to call me every name under the sun. It's my obligation to be able to hear it, to be able to reply. And it must be the tradition of this House, Mr. Speaker, for generations of democratic debate about the spending and about what this community will do, that the Leader of the Opposition and the Leader of the House are both here to hear the full debate. Speaking to the first, the given that the Leader of the Opposition has said repeatedly that the most important issue facing our community is the public financing. That's when he's not saying that the most important issue facing our community is the LNG facility. But when he has the finance bug, he says it's the public finances that matter the most, that he would have sat through the debate on the public finances. In particular, Mr. Speaker, you would have thought he would have wanted to be here to hear the speech of the person that he is likely to be describing in the coming minutes, hours, weeks, or months, as the other greatest civil servant of all time will be there with honor. Because God is sending him a Valentine card, and he doesn't know how else he can pretend to endear himself to him to pretend that they share political philosophy. Nothing could be further from the truth, because David Sam, as you will hear, is a man proud of not changing his spots when the other gentleman picks up spots as he walks along the street. But he didn't even, Mr. Speaker, honor the evacuation generation by being here to hear the one of that generation who was going to deliver a speech. Mr. Speaker, you're not supposed to deliver speeches, although you sometimes give it the benefit of your wisdom. But this member of the evacuation generation was giving a speech on the public finances, on the Gibraltar Savings Bank, Mr. Speaker, on the other book, the other book that operates two books, I'll come to that in a minute. But on the other book that I'm supposed to go today, there was a keynote speech yesterday, Mr. Speaker. And he wasn't here. Not just in breach of etiquette, Mr. Speaker, in breach of his own measure of what he says is the most important decision in our community. I suppose, Mr. Speaker, he didn't want to hear the things that Joe Bassano had to say. it was in fact, Mr. Speaker, a masterclass on how to run a savings bank, and I will come to it in a few moments. But the absence of the leader of the opposition from this House was probably the rudest parliamentary failure in the time, certainly, I have been a member of this House. And how one behaves in Parliament, Mr. Speaker, reflects on one's respect for democracy. If you make repeatedly points which is very important, but you're not willing to hear the response, Mr. Speaker, however much you may disagree with it, however much you may not like to hear it, Mr. Speaker, it shows your quality as a Democrat. I have sat through what I might verily describe as the most vicious attack on my colleagues and myself, or the most comedic parliamentary behaviour, depending on what mood one might be in the time that I've been a member of this House, having to put up with listening to all of that but venomous contributions, or the most boring contributions one might imagine, Mr. Speaker. But one is here, because Parliament, Parli, means talking. And it's not one-sided talking. It's not just hearing your own voice. It's not just putting your argument. Democracy is about the respect one gives to the other side as well, and how one takes it on board, Mr. Speaker, and develops one's thinking and puts it to people. And that is what was so rudely absent from the leader of the opposition's behaviour yesterday. Mr. Speaker, that was really the least parliamentary behaviour I've seen in the time I've been in the town. And he was wrong to lose, Mr. Speaker, also for another reason. Because if there's one thing that the brilliant Joe Bassano does well, it's speaking this House. As I told him when he spoke in the debate from the Dr. Hill Alvey Hill, I thought he deserved not one award of six for his advocacy, but two. And I think he should honestly be known as the Honourable Joe Bassano QCQC MP. Indeed, it's been a very good case for him to be called Sir Joe Bassano, but that is for another time. Probably one of the longest serving parliamentarians in the history of the Commonwealth. But the other side do like to do him down. And Joe Bassano QCQC MP, Mr. Speaker, yesterday explained. He loves being quoted to lawyers, I know. Just to explain, chapter and verse, pounds, shillings, in honour of the evacuation generation, and pennies, Mr. Speaker. What we are doing for savings bank depositors, how badly they did it in the time that they were in government, and the woeful state of the savings bank when we were elected in December 2011. But having said all that, Mr. Speaker, the leader of the opposition may not hear. Because I'm going to take you through exactly the same figures this morning anyway, because I know that they make him squirm, Mr. Speaker. And seeing him squirm is one thing that certain members on that side of the House, I think, love more than even members on this side of the House. And imagine me, Mr. Speaker, to hear Neil Costa. Well, Speaker, I don't think Neil Costa could be described as a forward B actor, even by his greatest detractors. But after his performance last night, nobody will ever be able to describe him as anything other than an absolute A listener. Mr. Costa was absolutely on fire. I think Costa was talking about fire. Somebody might think there's a fireball of AMG near Mr. Costa, but he was absolutely on fire yesterday, Mr. Speaker, if you can say this. He was absolutely on top form, Mr. Speaker. He was able to deliver an excellent rendition of the 4 years of hard work and effort that he has put in alongside this dedicated and committed team of ministers. It's a real pity that the Speaker of the Legal Revolution rudely decided to leave the House and missed such a brilliant performance of our nation. In fact, in particular, given how much the Legal Revolution needs to learn how to deliver a speech. Because you see, the other thing I see from watching Mr. Costa's brilliant delivery yesterday, given his flat and indescribably monotonous performance the day before. But the most incredible disrespect of this is by not being here, because the guys were quickly not there, not reserved for the Joe Gassano, Mr. CMP, or for Neil Costa, Mr. Speaker. The greatest mark of disrespect in the leader of the opposition's absence from the House yesterday was reserved for his own deputy, Mr. Speaker. Greatest enemy, I think, as he perceives him to be. Not for any of us in this side of the House, Mr. Speaker, because the greatest slap in the face, the harshest signal of division and disrespect, Mr. Speaker, he reserved for Mr. Speaker. What a way for a team leader to behave, Mr. Speaker, not to be here to listen to the speech of his own number two. These are speeches, Mr. Speaker, which require a lot of effort, and all members of this House, even the leader of the opposition, whose delivery was so uninspiring, Mr. Speaker, you're putting in a lot of work to these speeches. I mean, I think he probably didn't put in as much, because all he did was read his press releases of the past 6 months all over again. But honourable members put in a lot of work. I don't think the community realises the pressure that all members are under to deliver a good speech, to summarise in an hour or two, or perhaps even less, the work that they've been doing and how important it is and how it reflects on the spending of this community. And his own deputy, Mr. Speaker, got up to deliver his speech in the absence of his own leader. What a way for the leader of the opposition, indeed, Mr. Speaker, what a way for any leader of any team, for any leader of men and women, to behave for a key member of this team. And what he looked at, Mr. Speaker, was, as I will demonstrate in a few minutes, an excellent intervention in which I congratulate Mr. Speaker. He was actually widely congratulated last night, Mr. Speaker, by members on both sides of the House for what was a measured and erudite intervention, which made all the points he needed to make without stepping out to cause offence, and without failing, nonetheless, in his duty to bring us to account in one or two areas of real dispute between us, which I will deal with later in my intervention, but without having to call anyone anything. He didn't speak up. The only name that he used, the only insult that looked off his lips, the only off-colour reference, Mr. Speaker, was to have called one member of this House a nerd. But Mr. Speaker, he was actually applying that term to himself. When he described himself as a political nerd, and I said that I shared that description of self with him, and we shared that description with each other for many years since our very happy team at Baker. In fact, Speaker, in parliamentary terms, what we had yesterday from Mr. Defino was a breath of fresh air. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, is parliamentary oxygen when compared to the self-indulgent name calling that the honourable leader of the opposition that comes through in his reply over lunch on Monday. When Mr. Bassino spoke, Speaker, we repeated the loyal opposition of his best, probing and expressing, but never gratuitously insulting, again, congratulating on behalf of the government for that. But the current leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker, and I still can't, Mr. Speaker, not because I want him to go, I still hope that he remains the leader of the opposition for many years, will happily not be able to take any lessons from his deputy, and therefore will not be able to ape him. I don't know whether Mr. Professor, Mr. Nagel will allow me the use of the term ape, will not be able to ape him or learn from him and his excellent performance this season. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, there's one thing that I was happy about yesterday in historic terms, thinking back for a year or two. It was actually that the leader of the opposition managed to force through the executive of the DSP that they should vote in their leadership election through the intimidatory device of a show of hands, while in the much more democratic system of a secret ballot. I was delighted in historic terms, thinking back, that Mr. Peterson had managed that, and that therefore
this sort of setup on that issue, and were not able to express their views secretly and more democratically. I'm pleased that the Speaker may not be the case for many years to come. For many years to come. Because as Robert Gordon has said with the Speaker, he intends to stay as leader of the DSB, whatever happens at the next election. And I sincerely hope that is the case, Mr. Speaker. I sincerely hope that whatever happens at the next election, although I think we all harbour a view and a prediction that is probably common to all of us in their heart of hearts of what will happen in the next election. Whatever that may be, I do hope he remains as leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker. And I have no doubt, actually, that he will. Because whatever the result of the next general election, Mr. Speaker, even if the polls are wrong, and I don't mean polls, Mr. Speaker, all of them because we mustn't believe the polls. I don't know which particular poll it is he doesn't like or they don't want people to believe. But I don't come to rumour that the poll is one of them like that, Mr. Speaker. Even if the polls are wrong, and we win by 85%, and they only get 15%, and we win by 95%, and they only get 5%, the sort of thing that might happen if people lose trust in a leader and see that they've been hoodwinked with reports of danger, which are not really genuine. This sort of thing. Even if you only get 5% of the vote, he's right, he will remain a leader. Because he has built the executive of his political party in such a way that it is a reflection of himself and his family. He's got his brother and his executive, he's got his close friends and his executive. I think even if the people of Ghana were to come back now and he had lost the election by 95%, the executive would still put Danny back at the top of the party. Or looking to be in political terms, support. And that level of insulation and protection against a democratic result is I suppose, to be given only. But at least, Mr. Speaker, there isn't a stable chance in hell that the GSD is going to change its leader for a winner anytime soon. And there are people, Mr. Speaker, on our side of the political divide who are so incensed by saying the things that the Honourable Leader represents says, and the danger that he represents not to us, but to Gibraltar, and to the well-being of our community, as I shall demonstrate in a few moments, that they say we must just leave this guy, as people are wont to say in politics. And, Mr. Speaker, as I say to them, they mustn't succumb to that temptation. They need to realize that the Honourable Member, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, is the most important member of our team going into the next election. And when we were here, Mr. Speaker, debating the finances of our nation, the thing that he has repeatedly been saying until 2 weeks ago, was the most important issue facing, the central issue facing us in the next election, he was asking. And he was asking, Mr. Speaker, trying to deal with the after effects of having been rumbled on the conflict of interest behind his Lloyd's report. So I think his Lloyd's report, Mr. Speaker, not really. Was reported earlier. He's been rumbled, because having been taken cap for questioning the safety of LNG as a fuel for Gibraltar. £100,000, Mr. Speaker. A rumble, Mr. Speaker. But I think even now, too foolish to realize the extent of the rumbling. And so what do we do, Mr. Speaker? He made sure to anybody who was following this debate that his interest was actually outside the House. But all he is interested in doing now, having obviously lost the debate on the public finances, is to rouse the mob in any way he can to try and make his way to number 6 on the board. Well, Mr. Speaker, given how he's behaved in the past 4 days, people may start realizing that he's not such a bright spark. Yeah. yesterday he left this place to go and continue to fiddle that report, his sour grape tenders report, the sour grape failures report, which had been painful for him, so that he could question the safety of A&D. A question, Mr. Speaker. He went on to Waterford Terrace, Mr. Speaker, instead of being here at the time when he needed to be here. Members of this House, Mr. Speaker, traditionally, always, don't plan things for this week. Or to construct them, but there was a few CCC coming in there. Members of this House, Mr. Speaker, do not plan things for budget week, because it's the key political week of the year. This week and National Week are the two key political weeks of the year. We don't plan things in the evening because we don't know how late we sit. It's normal. But in the spirit of professional life, Mr. Speaker, when I was sitting on that side, a hard professional week might just happen to be combined with a hard political week if it was budget week, Mr. Speaker. And they didn't have the benefit they had, but I tell them when the budget week is going to be. So people used to scream it on us. We might say on a Thursday, and on Monday we're coming back, and that would be when we should do it, and today. But it's a check. Nobody planned for this week. So Mr. Speaker, can you see that the Honourable Gentleman planned and distributed a leaflet in their mendacious style to try and scare people? Meeting. Be scared half to death. 6 p.m. at the podium of Waterford Terrace. I think that's like an advert for a new movie. Poltergeist will be ready for you between 6 and 8. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the atmosphere. He planned not to be here, Mr. Speaker. He planned not to be here. He went down to Waterford Terrace, of course, to meet the hordes of people who were going to be there to hear his message of doom. And then he thought, well, do I leave the 15, 16 folks in the house and go and meet the thousands at Waterford Terrace? Or do I do honour to my duty as leader of the opposition and meet and stay with the 15 or 16 at the Parliament and leave the thousands waiting for me for the great Messiah to arrive, the man who will liberate them from the fireball to arrive? And he obviously was a teacher as a politician, did the political calculation, he said, out of the 17 there, 10 are never going to vote for me, they have to be mad about that, might be closer to 16, are never going to vote for me, so I'll go down and meet the horde awaiting me for their liberation from the danger of the fireball. I guess this speaker, he might have been a bit late, because when he left here before going there, he had to go and put on the sandwich board, Mr. Speaker. The sandwich board he walked around with, on one side says we're bankrupt, the debt is illegal, and on the other side says the end of the world is nigh by fireball. Which is the inspiring message that the opposition is telling our people about our future. So having put on the disguise, Mr. Speaker, and having made his way down to multiple territories, it turned out, Mr. Speaker, there were more people in this house than in the podium of Waterford Terrace. And in fact, even when you do the numbers, most of those who were there have turned up with you. You couldn't make it up, Mr. Speaker. In fact, there were more people in this house listening to Joe Bolsano and his deputy, Mr. Speaker, than the one the podium of Waterford Terrace is listening to him peddle the dirty business of one of the failed figures of the power station country. Mr. Speaker, when it comes to accepting, to question government, members of Parliament in the United Kingdom have resigned for less than what the Honourable Gentleman has been found doing. And if I thought it was in my partisan interest that he should go, I would be calling for his resignation immediately. But I've made that mistake once before, Mr. Speaker, and I have to apologize to his having called for his resignation before. Because much more muscular than operators than me have reminded me that the last thing I want is for him to do. So no call for a resignation today. In fact, what I want to do is to encourage him to continue with more of the same crystalline performance that he has been doing until now in the post of the revolution. As in fact, Mr. Speaker, he was doing the next time I saw him after he left the chamber yesterday, mobile phone is stupidly to ear, and he was then next to the scene entertaining Gibraltarian families on Carry On News Watch, or perhaps not the 9 o'clock news, given that News Watch is only at 8:30, Mr. Speaker. That was the next time he made an appearance. And let me deal, Mr. Speaker, with the spectacle that we were treated to yesterday evening. Speaker, last night on News Watch, honourable members of the Speaker reported the events of yesterday in the House. A serious issue, Mr. Speaker, about the partisan abuse of the Lloyd's Register technical report. That was the lead item, Mr. Speaker. And of course, it's a matter of substance about the dealings with engaged in detailing the people that supply. But before I get to the substance of it, Mr. Speaker, what I will say in response to what I saw yesterday on television about the response of the leader of the opposition to what happened in the House, a serious statement from the government, a seismic effect of it, is that it was really quite remarkable. Did he address the issue of the funding of the report by a competitor in a tender process, failed competitor in a tender process? Did he address that in any serious way? Did he apologize to the public in any measure, or indeed, Mr. Speaker, to his own party? Did he engage in the debate of what exactly the report was about and why he had cynically exploited his conclusions so transparently? Did he do any of that, Mr. Speaker? No, Mr. Speaker, he didn't do any of that. He didn't do any of that. And if I was thinking, Mr. Speaker, his performance said so much about him. Because the response from the leader of the opposition to having been rumbled on the abuse of the Lloyd's Register report, on his reliance on the sour grapes of a fair assembly, on him having taken this notion of £100,000 report, Mr. Speaker. It is possible to say that the Chief Minister is a Hollywood B actor. That's what he said. I know he was good as Mr. Foster, but I think he's a Hollywood A. I'm a Hollywood B Mr. Speaker, let me tell you, I sincerely welcome that. I sincerely welcome that. I really do. Because it says so much about him. It says so much about his style of politics. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, the way that on television last night, the venom dripped from the leader of the opposition's lips and tongue, it was clear to me, and I think to everyone in this community, that there was more of a risk to his life from his swallowing his own poison than there ever will be from a fireball of LNG. That's what he demonstrated last night. Indeed, it's clear that there is a new vein of support for the GOP. It's not doing that badly. There is a new vein of support for honourable members of it, which is patently from the most venomous and poisonous elements of our society. One just has to see that venom drip on social media. I guess that's the new GOP, Mr. Speaker. The GOP in which exciting things are happening. Really exciting things, I suppose, because I'm turning the leader turning up and saying, "Guess what, boys and girls? I have someone who's going to pay £100,000 report to rubbish the government's LNG proposal, and we're going to win the election by scooping up all the votes with water port territory."
something exciting that happened in the US.
In fact, Mr. Speaker, so exciting, and I understand the leader of the opposition told one particular member of the public who was keen to share the conversation with me, that despite the party's low ratings in the polls, they would win the election, Mr. Speaker. They would win the election. They will win the election, told this member of the public. And he said, for a simple reason, for a simple reason, because of the day, of which this lady, the gender of the person. They either, and this is what he said, they either vote for Pinky, I think that's what that means, I guess it is, for Pinky, when I'm telling them that he's going to put a bomb outside their front door, or they vote for me when I tell them I'm not. He's either them or. Can you think of all lawyers here, and even now I suppose it's going to sign a CCCC by acclamation. And we all understand the rules in your case, so I put very little stock by that, and there may be Chinese whispers in it. There might have been some reference to that paper as well, which I've heard him make the money. But it's so him, isn't it? It's so him, and it's so clear now what he's prepared to do to claw his way into Coventry. All he needs to do now, in his view, is to somehow tarnish our plans for the power station and the LNG storage and liquefaction facility. And that's why we've seen the events of the past 2 months develop as we have in respect of the debate on LNG. In fact, Mr. Speaker, the same in Spanish to describe that sort of close collaboration, which, given the announcement by the Honourable Mr. Ligouri about the teaching of Spanish in our schools, even our most infant children shouldn't be able to understand. And it involves the hambre, or the hunger, meeting las ganas de comer, the desire to eat or eat. Mr. Speaker, it is very clear to us now that that is exactly the sort of relationship that has developed between the Honourable Member and the Spark Group of Companies. I'm going to deal with this issue now, Mr. Speaker, and the substance of the report and the politics of it, Mr. Speaker. I've yesterday only made a factual statement. I have to now, I've been going up the dots for our community in political terms. And in doing so, Mr. Speaker, I want to emphasize one thing. And everything else I'm going to say after this, please be read with this caveat in mind. I am not, in what I'm going to say, imputing knowledge or seeking to punish anyone else on the opposition benches. I am not imputing to them any knowledge whatsoever of the things that I revealed yesterday and the things I am going to reveal now. I believe the only person on the opposition benches who knew the facts I disclosed yesterday, and who knows the facts I disclosed now, was the leader of the opposition himself. And if in shorthand I talk about the opposition, I do not mean to impute knowledge or motive to any other member of the opposition. Because, Mr. Speaker, it is only his insatiable hunger to become chief minister that I believe has been behind what we have seen. His insatiable hunger to become chief minister, whatever the consequences. That voting ambition of Macbeth, Mr. Speaker, which I referred to in a previous year and which blinds him completely, Mr. Speaker. It's the trick, Mr. Speaker, in Simon to talk in modern computer terms, which is programmed for him to become chief minister by any means necessary. And that is so dangerous, Mr. Speaker, in anything in life. When somebody is prepared to reach an objective, by any means necessary, morality goes out of the window. Common decency goes out of the window. Let alone, Mr. Speaker, I draw your attention to the Chief Minister, Mr. Speaker, to keep this in mind, that there is a rule, Parliament, 45-6, no member shall impute improper motives to any other member. I would ask him
and the president who is about to say, to keep that very much in mind. Indeed, Speaker, I have kept it in mind in preparing this remark because there is no improper motive in wanting to become Chief Minister. You have achieved it yourself. The motive is to become Chief Minister, Speaker, and there is nothing improper about that. It's about how one gets there, Speaker. And when one does things by any means necessary, whatever the motive, whether to become Chief Minister or otherwise, even morality and the family values of this community, the core of the Rock of Gibraltar, that makes us strong and steadfast, what has delivered our achievements, our values as a community, those strong family values, that goes out of the window when you achieve things by any means necessary. And that is what his desire to become Chief Minister by any means necessary is leading into. You see, Mr. Speaker, what has become transparent to our community today is that we have done a test with a commercial entity that left out in a fair process of choosing a new power station and a new LNG bunkering facility. A test worth £100,000. He has conspired, Mr. Speaker, against the interests of Gibraltar and its people in exchange for £100,000 paid in kind by a group of Russian and Gibraltarian businessmen who have shown an unscrupulous desire to make profit in however ruthless a manner as may be necessary. That is the reality of what we have seen unfolding before us in the past 24 hours. Of course, the Honourable Leader of the Revolution doesn't present it quite like that. He, as ever, pretends repetitive. He pretends he has a genuine concern. He pretends that this advice is not one motivated by commercial concerns and that it can therefore be taken at face value. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, although he doesn't in his past that he is politically very active, the chairman of the GOP, who appears to have come under some sort of spell by his dear leader, introduced the Lloyd's Register report to a press conference at the Elliott Hotel 2 weeks ago in a manner that we can now see was entirely deceptive. Entirely deceptive. And now, the lead of the opposition hangs him out to dry or accept that he shared in that deception. We can now demonstrate to the community that what Mr. Stenerhammond said was actually entirely untrue. It was actually the opposite of the truth. When presenting the report, Mr. Speaker, and you can see this on a YouTube video, unless they've hastily taken it down, Mr. Speaker, but if they have, we downloaded it. Mr. Hammond said this, as Danny, short term for the reader of the delivery, has said the report is by Lloyd's Register. Undoubtedly, Europe's most expert organization at providing these reports is not the world's most expert organization, and it needs to be made clear. Lloyd would not risk their reputation over something as relatively small to them as LNG bunkering in Gibraltar. And we demonstrated that yesterday. This report is straight down the line because Lloyd had absolutely no reason for doing otherwise. And then he said this. And as Danny has said, and therefore he can't really cut in this because he's repeated what Danny said, although Danny's not in the video, surprise, surprise. And as Danny has said, contrast that with the reports that will be produced by government, which will effectively be produced by commercial interests who have a vested interest in ensuring the project goes ahead because they will get an awful lot of money. That is what the chairman of the GOP said. The other leader of the Revolution is laughing. Maybe it's one of those laughters like the one that he was feeling when I finished my speech and he had to respond, of the thoughts that start in the bowel rather than in the brain.
He's laughing, Mr. Speaker, because he's been so caught out, Mr. Speaker, and his chairman has been so caught out, because actually, this is a very report that is the one prepared by a commercial interest with a vested interest, the opposite of what they pretended their report to be. Their report is one of people who will get an awful lot of money if we are not able to do the right thing for our community. They get elected, they cancel the plans, and then they give these people either another opportunity to bid, or have already done a deal that they're going to give them the power station or the facility.
Point of order. Now, I will very carefully listen to what he has to say. He has overstepped the mark by a country mile, but I have allowed it. But it's true that what he has now said is absolutely categorically false. Is imputing to me a motive. What he is saying is that effectively I have agreed to publish this report, but this report has been commissioned because of something that I promised from it. And that is absolutely wrong, and it's a lie, Mr. Speaker, and it is in breach of the rules of this House.
Mr. Speaker, the point of order contains the point of order, which is that I said something which is a lie. The Honourable Member needs to withdraw that. Before I deal with the point of order, the Honourable Member needs to withdraw the use of that in parliamentary language.
Last February, I recall that the Chief Minister actually called the leader of the opposition a liar. And it certainly escaped me and every other member in the House. I think, I don't know where it was stopped, even Mr. Peter Caruana was here. And no one raised the issue that the Chief Minister had called the Chief Minister the opposition a liar. So I didn't make a ruling at the time. But I kept it in mind that Honourable Member can see. So that on the next occasion when it happens, the reason why members did not call each other liars, did not say that they're lying, is that it is an accusation, if you like, an attack on the whole dignity of Parliament. In that all members here are regarded as being honourable persons, and that is why you don't call a member a liar. And therefore, the use of that word is unparliamentary and has to be withdrawn. You cannot call a member a liar, you cannot say that he is lying. As I say, it locked in my mind. I made a very careful note of the date when it happened, and I said, the next time I'm not going to let it by. So, it is a word that I ask for every member that uses this word, it has to be withdrawn. And then we can also deal with the question of whether there has been an improper motive on the part of the Chief Minister, which the leader of the opposition is entitled to defend himself, of course.
If Mr. Speaker wants me to formally withdraw the word lie, of course I have to do so. And Mr. Speaker, it is not. Mr. Speaker, the factual statement is this. He has said that effectively we have commissioned a report in exchange for favours. That is what he has said. It's an improper motive and it's in breach of the rules. And I am saying categorically to him here in his face that it is not true. I am entitled to say that that is not true.
Entitled to say that is not correct, that is not true. You are not using the word right, that is misleading. Those are words that are used normally in parliamentary that are not like. And I think what the in my view, what the leader of the opposition has said amounts to the job.
I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker. Now dealing with the issue of the improper motive. Mr. Speaker, I have no problem in this debate accepting that I am not imputing improper motive to the Honourable Member, but I will be bringing a motion, a substantive motion, that deals exactly with this point, and then we can deal with it. Mr. Speaker, the vested of interest are clearly on the side of the TSD, or rather, again, I'm careful to say, the leader of the opposition and Spark together conniving against the best interests of this community because of their commercial interest and his political interest. And Speaker, when I said that I wasn't imputing knowledge to members on the other side, just to him, I was very clear, Mr. Speaker, in saying that. Because actually, this debate is about trust and transparency. And as people will see as I get on with my reply, it's about dealing with the pretense of a lack of trust in government, the pretense of a lack of transparency by government that I will be addressing. But in accepting
connecting with the speakers I have when I set out, but he was only seen on the abolition benches that I promised with knowledge of the way this report was obtained. I also demonstrated, Mr. Speaker, that he lacks transparency with the rest even of his team, that he doesn't trust even the rest of his team, Mr. Speaker, that he is again a GOP leader behaving as a one-man band. And doing a deal, Mr. Speaker, with a defeated commercial operator, so whatever motive, Mr. Speaker, we will be able to look at that in more detail in the future, but invested interest, Mr. Speaker, drooping in sour grapes, funding their report, Mr. Speaker, and demonstrably the ones who have failed in their bid under this government. And what happened, Mr. Speaker, is that these vested commercial interests to which he has allied himself, to which he has married his political forces, put before Lloyd's Register a proposal so amateurish, Mr. Speaker, and so devoid of technical understanding that, of course, Lloyd's Register has said that it would be very dangerous and it should not be proceeded with without amendment. It is literally, Mr. Speaker, the equivalent of saying, dear Lloyd's Register, may I ask you whether I can trust my 3-year-old son with a bunsen burner and a lighter on the carpet of the living room? And Lloyd's Register would say, no, of course you can't. You shouldn't trust him with a bunsen burner until he's 50. You need to make sure that he uses it on the carpet. You should do it in a laboratory-style environment, and then he'd probably be all right. But make sure he wears goggles so he doesn't hurt his eyes and gloves so he doesn't hurt his hands. But if somebody were to put as primitive a suggestion as, may I please trust, can you tell me an advisor that I should trust my 3-year-old with a bunsen burner, some gas and a mat? The answer would be another one that Lloyd has given the clowns that have put the proposal to them. And anybody would have therefore rejected the suggestion, Mr. Speaker. And you see, Mr. Speaker, the thing that makes this debate even more puzzling is that what Lloyd's Register has said no to is not our plan for a power station or our plan for gas storage. It is a fool's plan. It is a nonsensical plan which no reasonably qualified person would ever have put to anyone. Let's go for a reputable organization such as Lloyd, whose reputation survives intact the leader of the opposition's attempt to marry them in this debate without their knowledge, Mr. Speaker. The plan put to Lloyd by the bright spark that starts, Mr. Speaker, was to have a single skin gas storage tank parallel to the Cruzeiro terminal. A single skin gas storage tank parallel to the Cruzeiro terminal. Mr. Speaker, that is the height of nonsense. Who would have done that? Of course you get the results that Lloyd has given me, and which venerable gentleman has quickly pedaled down to Waterford territory to fail. It could never be otherwise, Mr. Speaker. And that demonstrates, Mr. Speaker, that the whole purpose of the report was not to get a genuine opinion on whether gas and LNG storage, etc., there could work, and whether it was the right thing for our community. The whole purpose of seeking that report, the whole purpose of the celebrated commercial interest of staff, and the vaunting ambition of the leader of the opposition, the whole joint enterprise was to get a result that would discredit proper plans, which are carefully thought out, and to prejudice everyone against LNG. But this community, Mr. Speaker, is made up of right-thinking people who see through political devices like that. And Mr. Speaker, there's a lot more to go, by the way. And able gentlemen,
can get up and say that he's been patient and allowed me to do it. But actually, it's got nothing to do with that. He has got to sit and take it because I am the leader of this house responding on a bill, and I have the right to speak within the terms of parliamentary language in response to the speeches we have heard so far. So he's not allowing me to do anything with the speaker when he's sitting here listening to it, listening to how much we have been able to rumble his thoughts of the plan. But the speaker, why do I say that the plan has been thought out, the proposal put to words has been thought out to engineer a rejection, to engineer a statement that it is not safe? How can I justify that? Well, because he's the speaker. It is now absolutely clear to us, beyond peradventure, that by the time that Spark goes to low, their plans have been rejected by the government. So they are not going to low with live plans to get low to say they work so that they can come to the government with a report that says this works. They're not seeking validation of their plan. By the time they go to Rhodes, they have allied themselves to the Honourable League of the Opposition's cause, which has for 2 months previously already been to say that LNG should not be done there or in any other place in Gibraltar. They ally themselves to the rejectionist attitude. What they said 2 months before could be done, or 3 months before, or 6 months before, or any time before could be done, and they would do for good money. Suddenly, they want to be rejected. And they do that by the time we have not proceeded with them, and they have allied themselves to him. So by the time they are submitting their proposal to Lloyd, they are already seeking to ensure that the Lloyd's report is going to say the things that the leader of the opposition wants it to say. Mr. Speaker, I can reveal today in Parliament that Spark made proposals to the government outside of the tender process. They made proposals that were not compliant with our requirements and were technically flawed. They made proposals directly to ministers, and for those reasons, those proposals got nowhere. That was last year and early this year, Mr. Speaker. So that by the time that Spark go to road, they know that we've awarded a contract for a power station and not to them. And they know that we're talking to parties under the pin notice about gas supply which will not include them. And then they go to road. And that's when they put to road something as nonsensical as whether you should allow a 2-year-old to swim without watering. Something as nonsensical as whether you would trust a 3-year-old with matches. Something as nonsensical as whether you trust Daniel Keaton to run your country. Of course, the answer for anyone with any expertise is going to be no, as it will be from the electorate for the last question I posed, Mr. Speaker. But the welfare of responsible, reputable people, and according to Trevor, Mr. Speaker, they are being paid £100,000, what this bill he says. They then set out to put in writing what needs to be done to mitigate the risk of the nonsensical proposal that's been put to them. And one of the things they talk about is location, and another thing they talk about is method. And yesterday, Mr. Speaker, when in their frustration at the way in which their report was being distorted and used for political ends, something, let me be clear, Mr. Speaker, something Lloyds were not aware of. I can also disclose today that Lloyds were not aware that their report was going to be used for political purposes. So it was going to be handed to a political party. Already, when the government had pretended it was prepared for their purposes. Lloyd finally exploded, to use the terminology of the listening right, to apply Bill and Duke, with a statement that started to clarify matters. And that statement, Mr. Speaker, reproduced today, Mr. Speaker, in all of our national newspapers, so that everybody can read it for themselves and can understand for themselves what it says. That statement, Mr. Speaker, first sets out that they were not asked to consider LNG bunkering, although some of the things Mr. Speaker says he ruled out as a result of the report. I think he's ruled it out before, even without a report. And second, Mr. Speaker, they say that with obvious modifications, which are clearly necessary to the moronic proposal that was put to them, the risk, this risk to the report on the moronic proposal disclosure, and which Trevor and the leader of the opposition have been so keen to exploit, can be entirely reduced. Not my word, Mr. Speaker. They are in the advertisement that everybody can see in today's newspapers because the government has wanted everybody to be able to read the letter for themselves. And not even a generous view of the letter. The letter from Lloyd's Register themselves, or the statement from Lloyd's Register themselves. Not my word. The statement says the risk can be entirely reduced. Not a little bit reduced, and we can live with the risk. Not greatly reduced, and we can live with the risk. Entirely reduced. Completely. If you use the word completely, Mr. Speaker, and you want to emphasize it more, you're looking at the story and it says entirely. So this is completely reduced by our living banks here. More than just completely, entirely reduced. Eliminated, Mr. Speaker. Eliminated. What Lloyd is saying in his first statement, therefore, is that their way of making this facility is properly planned and applying the health and safety executive standard to it entirely safe, Mr. Speaker. And the leader of the position yesterday on television said, the statement on it's got a change of nothing. And this is nothing, Mr. Speaker. Seven of them have been peddling that this is impossible to do. They are still asking. Mr. Speaker, to say that this statement changes nothing in the debate suggests that it hasn't been read. But somebody's gone on television to defend their position on the report without reading the statement. It is absolutely incredible, Mr. Speaker, that our leader of the nation could think of nothing better to do last night than to formulate a B-rate factor and not deal with the fact that just this preliminary statement from Lloyd talks about risk being entirely reduced. I wonder, Mr. Speaker, whether the leader of the opposition explained it that way to a horde at multiple territories. I think the horse have read it for themselves, and that's why they were indoors watching Mr. Bettina and Mr. Bassano and Mr. Costa and Parliament talk to you. But what a disgraceful way to do politics. Scaring favours on the Monday and scaring residents for their mistake on the Tuesday. And then those, Mr. Speaker, further down their statement. Go on to talk about the health benefit of LNG because it can mean less urban pollution from the burning of diesel, that is the honourable gentleman says the word is true, and how commercial and bunkering activities can be promoted. None of that was ever said in the hyperbole of the presentation of the report by the honourable leader of the opposition 2 weeks ago. Open any of that was said in multiple territories yesterday, Mr. Speaker. None of that. All they're doing is peddling fear of risk and danger. Fear of risk and danger which the people who they rely on say can be entirely reduced, although eliminated, give you a word. I'm hoping, Mr. Speaker, that in translation they might understand what we mean. Thank you.
they are covering that fear of risk and danger. Fear of accidents based yesterday, yesterday evening at multiple territories, on a report that has been distributed, not because of the expertise of the people who prepare it, whose reputation stands in touch, but because of the submission of a nonsensical plan by a vested commercial interest. Let me share something with members of this House and those of the community who might be watching this program. 2 weeks ago, the Sunday after the Germany game, when actually this a few days after or before the report was made public by members of it, I had a meeting with the director of Spark on a Sunday in my office on the issue of the power cut that we had suffered during the Germany game. Because I think it's entirely appropriate that the Chief Minister should consider power such an important issue, power generation, if you cannot political power generation is such an important issue, but if there is a massive failure from a contractor that supplies to the government, but you need to be on top of those things and dealing with them. I don't mind telling the public, Mr. Speaker, that on the night of the Germany game, where the Germany game was still on because of the power cut, I was, with Manolo Rossi and the minister responsible, actually down at the Spark plant and down at Gibraltar to try and understand what was going on. Of course, didn't know really what was happening at the time, as we now know. The light of the new dawn has now shone even on what has been happening and going on between the League of Liberty and the Spark. But that Sunday, Mr. Speaker, I required a meeting with one of the directors of Spark to seek explanations, Mr. Speaker. Damien Cabrera, the director of Spark to Consumer, volunteered, because I did not ask him this question, Mr. Speaker, this was after the report had come out. He volunteered, because it wasn't something I would put to him, in my office, in the office of the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, confronted that they, he said, Mr. Speaker, had nothing to do with the preparation of the Lloyd's report which had been provided to the opposition. Nothing to do with it. I didn't ask him a question, I wasn't just examining him, but members have said right. This person came into the office of the Chief Minister of Gibraltar and volunteered this now patently false information. It's my concern that they were actually the ones preparing the report with the leader of the opposition. Because these are people who lie to the face of the Chief Minister, disrespect that office, and not stay them together with it. They disrespect every single one of the people of Gibraltar. Every single one of the people of Gibraltar. And that version, Speaker, was a falsehood, an untruth, a lie told to all of the people of Gibraltar through my office. A deception, Mr. Speaker, in which the leader of the opposition is not a bit clear, Mr. Speaker. Quite unlike me, Mr. Speaker, you see, he's no B actor. He is an A-lister of deception, Mr. Speaker. He's the star of this Hollywood movie. He's at the very top, Mr. Speaker, of a conspiracy that had no regard for the interests of our nation and every regard for his own personal interests. You see, Mr. Speaker, we have here, but we have here in an election year, because this is clearly an election year, and these rules in the law provide for it, is a disgruntled company conspiring with the leader of the opposition to turn an election. There is, Mr. Speaker, I can tell the nation today, potential interference with critical national infrastructure. We are investigating whether the power cuts we have experienced have been brought about in order to destabilize the government at a time when the opposition wanted to have the debate about power generation and its future. And I am not a conspiracy theorist, Mr. Speaker. I believe that all this is said, and that Jack Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey plausible, and that there wasn't a second gunman on the grassy knoll in the speaker. But the coincidences we have experienced with the failure of the spark run and the timing of it, as well as the timing of the collusion between the League of Liberation and Spark, leads us to have to investigate these things. Let me be clear, Mr. Speaker. Our gaming companies, our lawyers, our accountants, our insurance companies, our finance centre, all our business leaders, the elderly, the infirm, those with babies and young children, not least our football fans, Mr. Speaker, will never forgive the Honourable Leader of the Opposition if we have suffered power cuts for him to push the issue of power generation further up the political agenda. Because it's one thing, Mr. Speaker, to take industrial action, give notice of when you're going to do it, and be covered by the trade union dispute back in the 70s and 80s to fight for parity and pay rises. But it's quite different, Mr. Speaker, to bring about power cuts in the country with the largest gaming industry on earth during a Euro qualifying game.
That he is now going beyond, completely going beyond what is reasonable, what is parliamentary. What he is really saying is it's completely and utterly untrue. It's false. It's untrue. He is saying that I have been at the centre of a conspiracy to a large power cut. That is absolutely untrue, Mr. Speaker. And that kind of accusation has never been made in this House. And he is breaking parliamentary rules, and he is exceeding what is proper by a country mile, Mr. Speaker. And I know, because it has been brought to my attention, that indeed Sparks have today come out with a statement after disputing all this question of them being responsible for power cuts, Mr. Speaker. But Mr. Speaker, what you're saying about me is absolutely false, it's not true. And quite frankly, this should be brought to order because this is unparliamentary and beyond the rules of this House. And Mr. Speaker, I am prepared to accept the position that the Honourable Gentleman takes. He says he has nothing to do with it, and I sincerely hope, for the sake of our democracy, that he doesn't. And if he says he doesn't, Mr. Speaker, I have no evidence to suggest the contrary, and I accept his word. He has told the people of Gibraltar today in the Parliament that he has nothing to do with it. I have been talking only about this. So, Mr. Speaker, he says he has nothing to do with it, and as a Democrat and as a member of this Parliament, Mr. Speaker, I sincerely hope that that turns out to be true. We'll see. We'll let the investigations take their course, Mr. Speaker. But we'll accept, of course, that if it turns out that he is found to have been involved, then his denial today will be even more of an indictment of his involvement and will mean that he is finished not just as leader of the opposition, but politically forever, Mr. Speaker. But I accept his position. I accept his position. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, let me quickly look now at what it is. Oh, by the way, dealing with the Spark statement, which I haven't seen, surprise, surprise, Mr. Speaker, that Spark has said that they have nothing to do with it. Well, Mr. Speaker. And he immediately knows about it. Well, no. Mr. Speaker, also social media, Mr. Speaker, well, then the leader of the opposition would know about it if it's on social media, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, let us quickly look at what the collaboration which has been established between the leader of the opposition and Spark has done for Gibraltar so far. The local member may be familiar with a publication called Bunker World. Indeed, I think it's a publication we have sometimes debated in this House when reports have appeared in Bunker World. People who do bunkers, some of our best clients, Mr. Speaker, rely on what's said in Bunker World. Bunker World, Mr. Speaker, on the 11th of June, Gibraltar set aside bunkering report. Bunker World, Mr. Speaker, on the 15th of June, LNG bunkering report at centre of political row in Gibraltar. But, Mr. Speaker, on the 23rd of June, in Bunker World, with LNG being the hot topic in the bunkering industry, with Ahasuerus fighting to be the Western Mediterranean top bunkering port for LNG
in the future. So this being the subject related in all the bantering conferences in the world, with Gibraltar under this government trying to see whether we can continue to be the leaders in this field, but with him having already said that he rules out LNG bantering. On the 23rd of June, thanks to Daniel Seaton's collaboration with Spark in Bunker World, led by all our clients and the ones we want to be our clients, Gibraltar, LNG bunkering plans in disarray. Thank you, Spark. Thank you, Daniel Seaton. That is what the world is reading about Gibraltar as a result of the donation in kind of £100,000 allegedly to the GOP by the provision of this report by somebody who has been a member for 12 years and is a supporter that wants to help the GOP, according to the way it was put, I think, on one occasion by members of it. Bad, bad publicity for the voter, Mr. Speaker. And then, Mr. Speaker, what do we find that the industry talks about at the same week that the Gibraltar banking in disarray headline hits the international press in Bunker World? What's the other headline on LNG, Mr. Speaker? Carnival Corporation. She purchased the four biggest cruise ships in the history of cruising to carry 6,000 passengers and propelled by LNG. That's stories and regurgitation on board. Well, look at the head of Carnival, it's reading, whether to bring his cruise ship passengers on the Western Mediterranean port to either Singapore or Gibraltar. And he reads this in the same publication that he's reading his press release on. We don't seem to be advancing our common cause as a people. Carnival obviously now thinks that carrying passengers in LNG fuel ships with gas storage and the participation on board is safe. Cruise ships will therefore likely be made in this way in the future. Carnival is one of the leaders in the industry. It is likely that other companies will pursue what Carnival is pursuing. Carnival is using that as a selling point for people who want to lower their carbon footprint as a moral issue when they cruise. And the other gentleman, apart from the bad press he's giving us, has already said publicly that there will be no LNG bunkering in Gibraltar when he becomes chief minister. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid he's not popular in the port. Having written off LNG bunkering, Mr. Speaker, as he has, he's written off the medium and long term future of our port and the jobs that go with it and the revenue that goes with it. He's not concerned about revenue, Mr. Speaker. He's not about putting commercial concerns before safety. He's not concerned about revenue. The things can be done safely. People will be doing them. People will be in that market. Look, if you have concerns about safety, the things don't fly. You shouldn't go flying to Gibraltar Airport if you have a zero-risk mentality. Especially if you think that the air traffic controller might be too busy reading a report. And of course, Mr. Speaker, one of the things he's also writing off is our future as a cruise port. Imagine what this would do to our passenger numbers, let alone our bunkering revenue. Mr. Vecina yesterday, in a much more visionary view of where Gibraltar should be going, said that one of his dreams, shared by all of us on this side of the house, Mr. Speaker, is making tourism a more important and reliable part of our economy going forward. I can't say pillar, Mr. Speaker, because leaving council, twice sitting next to me would make me sit down because, of course, he doesn't believe that there are any pillars other than our people and our land and the best use of them, but an important part of our economy going forward. But, Mr. Speaker, if we say that we can't have LNG facilities and storage, and it's so dangerous, we won't even allow an SPS out in the centre of the bay. Surely, if we're going to be consistent, not the forte of the leader of the division, by any measure, we would also be saying that the cruise ship cannot get at Gibraltar, because they are within 400 metres of waterfall territory, Mr. Speaker, where there are even maybe 900 to 1,000 people living. Never mind, there are going to be 6,000 sleeping on top of the tank.
Peter, what would this nonsense commitment do? What would this nonsense commitment do that he has given not to do LNG bunkers? So we wouldn't be able to say LNG bunkers to the preacher, so they're going to have this storage facility, and they wouldn't be able to come in, and we wouldn't have the huge increase in passing the numbers, which would enable me to reply to Mr. Bassino in the future budget debate even more thoughtfully about how well we're doing in passing the numbers, and we're told might be lower, because he has, in one shot, assassinated and blown up two industries, banking and food manufacturing. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm just passed by the technologically savvy Albert Isola, an article appearing a moment ago, which I also have to refer to, this house and to the community, appearing in a publication that is known for its devotion and love to the rock and the people of Gibraltar, called El Confidencial Digital in Spanish. ElConfidencialDigital.com. The other gentleman might want to. When I read this to him, he will want to put it on social media. So it's ElConfidencialDigital.com, and if the person is a button in his iPhone, he can then put it on Twitter or Facebook. And Twitter talks about it has a full heading, security, I say, in Spanish. Risk of catastrophe in Spain because of the new gas facility in Gibraltar. Subheading. A report from Wales assures that an incident at the plant would affect thousands of people.
Incredible.
Incredible. I thought this was the only thing I was going to be able to point to the damage that they were doing, that he was doing to Gibraltar in his marriage with Bath. And yet, look at that. Our best friends are aligning themselves with him. And Mr. Speaker, I could not have come at a better moment, as this was very stressful, because I was about to move on. In relation to the power station generally, and not just the LNG aspect, that the overwhelming of the opposition has the ignominy of being quoted with approval by the Partido Popular leadership in Brussels. Not just in Confidencial Digital, but by the Partido Popular leadership in Brussels, Mr. Speaker. So not content with rubbishing Gibraltar's reputation in the banking world, and I'm not going to suggest he's rubbishing our reputation with our confidential digital readers. They hardly have a high regard for us, I'm sure, Mr. Speaker. He has now become the poster boy of the Partido Popular leadership in Brussels. This is what Señor De Grande, the leader of the Partido Popular in the European Parliament, had to say to the Commission in a question a couple of weeks ago. Question to the Commission. According to local press reports in Gibraltar, congratulations to our media who are obviously very far and wide. According to local press reports in Gibraltar, the leader of the main opposition party in the colony, even they understand that there might be another one soon, given the job he's doing, the Gibraltar Social Democrat, Mr. Daniel Peter, they are quoted by name, by some of the others, has announced that after months of study, it turns out it was actually just June that they were studying, after months of study in which he consulted experts in power generation and the environment, he is opposed to the construction of a new electric power station in the north mole of the harbour, doing work in progress on the mole for the project. The reason is that he believes the plant would endanger public safety. The leader of the Gibraltarian opposition recently drew attention to the risk of explosions on the new thermoelectric power plant which the local authorities in Gibraltar are building. Before the Lloyd's report, Mr. Speaker. One, has the Commission received detailed information about this project? Two, has the Commission assessed the risk to the safety of residents near the project for a new electric power station on land to be reclaimed from the sea in the north mole of Gibraltar Harbour? Thank goodness, Mr. Speaker, that this community can rely on this government convened with the people, not even on this government, but even on this administration, on the professional work that the civil and public servants of Gibraltar do in everything they turn their attention to, not the politicians, the guys on the ground, Richard Montalvo, Manovia Lesbian, legal geographers of this world, super professionals in what they do, whether they do it for us or they do it for them when they're in government, Mr. Speaker. The people who make the role to fix, Mr. Speaker. Thank goodness that they do things so well, so conscientiously, that they care so much about their community, so much more, Mr. Speaker, than they who recklessly throw away these remarks that are then picked up by the people of the world. That even our old antagonists, let other than Peter Babylon's favorite, Mr. Arias Benyogi, have to read out this answer, which must have stuck in his throat a little bit. This is the answer given by Sr. Arias Benyogi in the commission. In answer to question one, the commission has received no information about the project for a power station in Gibraltar. There is no EU legislation requesting a member state to inform the Commission on its detailed energy projects, except for nuclear infrastructure. The safety assessment of the project is under the sole responsibility of the member state without any assessment from the Commission. That's not what happened to me, quote, if we've done anything wrong, Mr. Speaker, under the Commission, it would fail in some way, Mr. Speaker. Then they would have had a field day with us. So, my thanks, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the people of Gibraltar, to the professionals who are dealing with the new power station project and the LNG facility, and who are under so much pressure as a result of the unquestionable behavior of the leader of the I'm dealing with how the Honourable Gentleman manages to assist to help those to work with those almost to speak on a authority, although not in the same room and probably not even talking to each other. All of those who want to rub us to the world internationally. And in doing so, I want to analyse what he said in this house on Monday and what he said about what he said in this house on Monday on television. Instead of I was leaving a government that does not deserve the trust of the people because it is the most opaque government in the world's history. And yet, Mr. Speaker, forget the numbers of meetings. There are more meetings than ever. They ask more questions than ever. They give more information than ever. But already, absent the meetings, there is more information in the public domain than ever. Not just more meetings, Mr. Speaker. All the information that we used to ask for, which they sometimes didn't give, and the information that they did give, is now provided monthly on the website, and the only issue that they say is that sometimes, because of the pressure that the people in our statistics office are under, and the magnificent job that they do, and they produce the brilliant census while doing it, they sometimes, a couple of days later, they may not be able to ask the question based on the latest available statistics. Mr. Speaker, there are reams of information for that. The information that we have to pull like teeth and sometimes didn't succeed in obtaining is now available online. What don't we give them? We don't give them the name of the borrowers of Credit Finance Company Limited. And we don't share their view about the way that companies, government companies, are incurring expenditure and how they use the money in the pool of companies. That's not to give them information. That's not to share their view, Mr. Speaker. They have no information about the savings on the other hand. They have it every month and we used to have it before at a different time. It's really quite incredible, Mr. Speaker. Do you think that people believe this, Mr. Speaker? And then we're going to condemn our spending priorities, Mr. Speaker, and on the new power station. He still was saying on Monday, Mr. Speaker, we're going to cancel our contract and he was going to go back to there, Mr. Speaker. So that from the mole or the upper rock, Mr. Speaker. Can we put this on the corridor of the Barbary Partridge up at Lansbury, or we put it on the new land at North Mole, Mr. Speaker? So we're going to put a
got our station and left about. And you want to get, I see people going, they're doing left, right, left, right. And you preempted that in this room. You say, oh, I'm going to be saying left, right, left, right. Say it again. Nothing more, because he's very clearly right. He has adopted the methods of the right wing. He's adopted the policies of the right wing. But he's condemning Gibraltar to pick up the debate on rock, no, rock, no, rock, no. He didn't realize what he's doing to people. He's saying we should go back to the old plan that he's elected. I think he could, Mr. Speaker. It will require another couple of years of getting the tendering back, getting the environmental assessment back. Incredible, Mr. Speaker. I know I'm a Speaker. I have to give it straight away to start, Mr. Speaker. It will take years to be able to get the power station project going again up at Lafayette. And then you said this, Mr. Speaker. What we have witnessed over the last 4 years is the systematic destruction of parliamentary governance and development. The use of the Gibraltar Savings Bank to fund government expenditure and projects of Credit Finance Company Limited and Gibraltar Investment Holding Company Limited. And he said, Mr. Speaker, that this was a complete nonsense of the budget, because rather than being open and transparent, as he said, I've done everything I could to keep from taxpayers what I am spending their money on, and I haven't paid it straight to taxpayers, he said. Well, Mr. Speaker, what does he think I'm spending on? Even assuming that he were right in everything else that he says, which I will demolish in a moment, how does he think that I am spending this money in a way that taxpayers are not aware of? Can't he see the claims? Doesn't he see what we are building? Does he think we're spending money? Well, okay. And what? On February 9th, our number 6, the palace. We're looking for it here. You might not agree with it. It's in the book. But if you think you might not agree with it, it's there. So the idea that we're hiding the spending, the problem is that he identified that we're spending and said he wouldn't do it. But then he doesn't say with clothes that he wouldn't do, because he doesn't want to annoy the people who want the birth at the marina. He doesn't want to annoy the people who are going to have their children in the new school. He doesn't want to annoy anyone, Mr. Speaker. It's about wanting to be all things to all men and being seen through by everyone, Mr. Speaker. And the able to win him a guarantee that everyone sees through him, even the people sitting around him. And the fact that we're spending via companies, Mr. Speaker, that is the most serious offense we have ever committed. What about them? And they're spending from companies. Where does that leave the greatest Gibraltarian of our time, as he described in our book about censure? If I'm the worst people ever for that reason, how can he be the greatest Gibraltarian of our time? I mean, it's just incredible, Mr. Speaker. I believe I'm looking to lend £20 million to developers to develop something in the middle of the town and become an equity partner of them. Same thing, by the way, Mr. Speaker, we found out only because I asked the question in this House. Apparently, the most serious way of finding anything out. And then he said, Mr. Speaker, he didn't know how the eye-watering debt of $847 million, which is wrong, but it's his calculation, how would that pay back? Well, I'll come to a moment to a part of my address where I'm going to adopt all of his theories and show him the effect of them on the GDP ratio, Mr. Speaker. And he said, Mr. Speaker, that the architect of the rainy day fund, the disciple of budgetary discipline, and I've not given you any one thing, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bacana, the Honourable, has left the man in charge of his party. There is absolutely no conviction for the core values of those founding fathers of the GSOP as far as these issues are concerned. I thought we couldn't talk about fathers and GSOP. I thought that elicited an immediate crackerjack from the Honourable Gentleman. Well, you know, look at the rainy day funding. Look at them. Is it the big horrible two things that have undone the rainy day fund? No. The rainy day funds were undone, as Renegade the backbencher said yesterday, by him, who did the big philosophical divide of the 90s and noughties, as he described it,
was the divide between global finance, rainbow fund theory, and this spend for growth theory. That's what the honourable, the backbencher, with the honourable gentleman described as the greatest return of all time, or our time, because everyone shall know the daughter of the other great civilization. That's what he said, Mr. Speaker. And that has happened in that respect. Now, isn't there an element of consistency here? Are the rainy day funds at zero? Am I using that awful looking sinister that I've spent all this money and I'm done the rainy day funds? Have I stopped the father of the GSRP from accumulating rainy day funds? And by the way, this idea that anybody is left in charge of the GSRP is really a GSD way of thinking, Mr. Speaker. The GSRP belongs to all its members, Mr. Speaker. Not run by one man. It was not run by one man when the Honourable Gentleman was the leader or when I am the leader. We really are a democratic party of all our members. Clearly, and in particular given what we've discovered about the way the Lloyds report was handled, it's not the case on the other side. So what has happened to the Rainy Day Fund? Rainy Day Fund inherited from opposition re community care. In other words, assuming that by giving money to community care that independent trust, what we are doing, and this is an issue that has appeared in social media recently, is not requiring the consolidated fund to give them money to pay pensions, because they have their own fund, they do it independently, and therefore we don't have to go the GOP method of giving them the cash at each year so they can spend it. How much was in that on the 9th of December 2011? And we left it at 65 million in 1996, and let me think, at rates of about must have grown by 35% inflation, it would have been in the region of 60%, or must have been in the 100 million in the time of it. Zero, Mr. Speaker. So if he is a disciple of the rainy day funds, here, he seems to be factoring that in before he calls the greatest libertarian of all time, the person who allowed the trustees to have to spend that money and didn't continue to give them capital. Zero. How much have we given, Mr. Speaker? 134 million in total by the end of this financial year. It's because it's a manifesto commitment, Mr. Speaker. But yes, if that is the way to honour the founder of the GSRP by demonstrating commitment to the Rainy Day Fund philosophy, and everybody describes that as one of the Rainy Day Fund ways, complete independence of the government, well, honour number one, Mr. Speaker. And the savings bank fund, Mr. Speaker, it was 30 million. Joe Bufano told us yesterday in 1996, he wanted to hear it. 30 million. So, I mean, inflation, like all of it, 60 million by the time we came in on the 9th of December 2011. 100 million. It was a zero, Mr. Speaker. The other established rainy day fund of this community, in the savings bank, in its reserve, Mr. Speaker, zero. So how can you dare to get up and preach about rainy day funds, Mr. Speaker? He doesn't know what he's talking about, Mr. Speaker, and he's demonstrating it by putting himself in the firing line with remarks such as that, which is so easy to reply to. And Mr. Speaker, he says, you operate in two books. One book, which is the budget, and the other book, which is your borrowing from the savings bank. And that's off balance sheet. That's a classic term, which is accounting sheet, off balance sheet. So he's used that term. He doesn't capture the United Nations. It's off balance sheet. Have you looked at the balance sheet, Mr. Speaker? This is the balance sheet of our community, Mr. Speaker. It's an estimate. The one that comes out after this debate is the actual. And it sets out the revenue and expenditure, Mr. Speaker, that we expect. And then the auditor audits this, Mr. Speaker, things who have forgotten on television recently when he was debating with me that we had an auditor, Mr. Speaker. Can I ask him and anybody else in our community who might have managed to have a copy to hand to look not in the detail hidden away of this book, but in the index, Mr. Speaker? Can I invite you, Mr. Speaker, to look up the word savings bank? Indeed, savings bank fund, appendix L, page 210.
balance sheet, Mr. Speaker. It's on the index of the balance sheet. All he needs to do is his homework, his understanding. All he needs to do is look at the numbers. And then he gets a breakdown of where the money is invested in detail, Mr. Speaker. And then all that is reflected in the orders of the clouds, Mr. Speaker. And what happens to the bank? He says, we're hiding it. It's our balance sheet. It's more on the balance sheet, Mr. Speaker. We're talking about it. He disagrees with how we're spending it. He says,
well, I'm sure he would do it if he were here, Mr. Speaker.
But where can you convince the argument that this is off balance sheet, that we're operating two books? No, Mr. Speaker. It's the same book, Mr. Speaker.
It's so difficult to argue, Mr. Speaker, with somebody who lacks understanding. And I so miss Peter Cabrera, Mr. Speaker. And I know I'm not the only one. Because at least when you argue with somebody who knows what they're talking about, it's easier to reach some conclusion. Even if the conclusion is that you agree to disagree. But there is something given, Mr. Speaker. And one has to be a dyed-in-the-wool disciple of the Honourable Gentleman. One needs to see him as a political messiah, and actually after today he's more likely to be seen as a political pariah. To believe that there is anything hidden, Mr. Speaker, is in the same book. And Mr. Speaker, this is soon to be available for £5.
I think we should be charging more, just for paper worth more than £5 then.
Can you make a concern that there are two books? And that things are not going through the house. I might disagree with what we're doing with it. That's fine. He's paid to do that, to disagree with Mr. Speaker. At least that's his interpretation of the law operation.
And he says that there is growth and 10% and all the rest of it, but it's all being fueled by government spending.
I had a whole section there I was going to refer him to about that, Mr. Speaker. I've gone back to the handshake where Sir Peter had indicated that that was the way he was using. But thankfully, Sir Peter himself yesterday explained his spending for growth criteria and explained that in particular, when there was a time of crisis and banks were not lending, it was important that the government spend in our community, Mr. Speaker, and when there were projects to be done. Thinking now, Sir Peter says that we've done most of the projects that need to be done. He would say that, wouldn't he? But he explained this, Mr. Speaker, in a way that just so completely flies in the face of what his new leader, his successor, has said in the course of this debate, but at least I understand why the only part of Sir Peter's arrogant valedictory goodbye to the Parliament that he had to read was the book in which he pretended to praise him. It wasn't lost on any of us, Mr. Speaker. I think that his eulogy of Sir Peter was much shorter than mine, and that Sir Peter's eulogy of him was the only part of his speech that he had to carefully write and read, Mr. Speaker. It certainly didn't come naturally. And then dealing with the issue of LNG, Mr. Speaker, in his speech he said this. Asked by the interviewer on TVC, he said this about the things he said in his speech. He spent the last part of your address tackling the issue of an LNG power station and banking facility at the North Node. Is this a key electoral issue for you? Of course, the key electoral issues have been nepotism before, now that we've demonstrated that there's no nepotism. And in fact, we do more work with people on that side than we do with every other sector of the community because they're open to all, we don't talk about nepotism. Then it was the stadium, but 1% of people in the poll, which we did believe, said that the stadium mattered to the election, and 99% said it didn't. The poll there, the stadium is no longer relevant. So now the key electoral issue is LNG. But it wasn't the risk of it, I hadn't run the load before. But he said this. Absolutely. I can give you a cast iron guarantee, well, his guarantees aren't worth much, to all those people living in walkable territories, in West Side 1, in West Side 2, in Europlaza, in Peninsula House, this LNG banking facility the government is planning to build is not safe. And if we are elected, not only will that not be built, but we will not build an LNG power station at North Node.
This LNG banking facility. He doesn't know what LNG banking facility we're going to do. That's his other complaint. And we haven't settled on the plans yet. So, how can he say it's not safe? How can you be against something that is not yet planned? Something that is not yet out in the public domain, what is he against? Maybe what he's against, Mr. Speaker, is the single skin tank alongside the cruise liner terminal, which would require cruise liner passengers to get onto the ship like this. Let alone the danger of it, Mr. Speaker, being single skin. And he said, anyway, it's going to take 4 more years to build that power station, so we can step by problem, so only looking into the future, like we looked into the future and said he's going to win the 2019 election, even if it's not held in that year. All of this is just a ball game, Mr. Speaker, to step by problem, we may as well scrap it, start from scratch, and he's going to build a new power station immediately in his next term, because that's going to take 4 years. It's going to take 2 years, it's not going to take 4 years, Mr. Speaker. So it doesn't really stop that, Mr. Speaker, although engineering is engineering. And Speaker, it's the wrong decision to go back to that LNG. And if he were sitting here, he would be saying what I am saying about LNG being the future and the future. But he's not sitting here, but he wants to sit here. And he's just thinking about both, he's not thinking about the both. But the greatest libertarian of all time, in his estimation, told him this thing, because the time has come to stop thinking in purely partisan terms and they're thinking about the future of Gibraltar. And he's not taking his erstwhile leader's advice, but I suppose I shouldn't be surprised if he's taking my. But look, if he doesn't want to take my advice, I don't mind. I mean, that's his problem, because he never takes my advice. Osama, Caruana, Picardo, all those names he hates in different ways, Mr. Speaker. We're all different, we've all done things in different ways, in different times, and in different styles. But, Mr. Speaker, the one thing that we have in common is that we have led in teams, not a visionary failing team, Mr. Speaker. So I'm really happy that he's not going to follow Joe's advice on debt. He's not going to follow Peter's advice on a non-partisan approach, or my advice on anything, because Pace performance, Mr. Speaker, might twig and start listening, and we might turn things around. And one particular issue where we have a serious disagreement is this issue of finances. I've dealt with the fact that he says that we have to book and then can't scrutinize things. He actually can, because they're in the same book, and he scrutinizes them every month, Mr. Speaker, which is rather prerogative, that he is wrong. Every month we have the same debate about what we're spending on. Every month he's looking at things with a magnifying glass, which is fine. That isn't perfect, but it demonstrates that we're looking at it, and it demonstrates that there's parliamentary scrutiny. And then Mr. Speaker says, on track, the Chief Minister is prepared to answer no to the question whether the government has directly or indirectly provided any loans to the owners of the Sunbourne. And in fact, a government-owned company had been provided a loan, had provided a loan of between 30 and 40 million pounds. And look, Mr. Speaker, when he wants to scare people, he says, this is public money. It's not the government's money. When you want to say I'm a liar, he says it's the government's money. And when I ask you whether the government has won, you said you haven't. So look, he could make up his mind, Mr. Speaker. He says, either I am profligate in spending savers' money, and therefore your savers have to be careful, or it's government money, and I should have answered yes. He's done that in both ways. I put it to his direction. At least if it's Mr. Ben Fahim, Mr. Speaker, his executive doesn't appear to have agreed with him on this subject, having written for the Chronicle saying about this subject, true, that it wasn't government money. But then he went on to say that this is all done through a company we have incorporated in secret. I mean, if he just said these things, Mr. Speaker, he says these things. Every time he opens his mouth, it's because his brain is full out. I'm thinking he should take an action against his brain for failing to perform. How can you say that a company has been incorporated in secret? It's not possible to incorporate companies in secret. There is a company's registry. The company only exists when it's on the registry. The registry is public, Mr. Speaker. And he's a lawyer with Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker. But he's not QCQC, I don't know how to do it. It is impossible to incorporate a company in secret. Look, the debate, do you think this is good for you? The debate today internationally, sometimes he might sit on the news and he might probably not suffer in front of his eyes and he might not realize his life.
is about whether we should disclose in all of Europe, and indeed in the rest of the world, the ultimate beneficial ownership of companies on the register. It's not about whether companies are public or private in the hidden sense. It is not possible to incorporate a company in secret. And I suppose it means you go to Liechtenstein, you appoint some nominee directors, you leave a letter as to what happens when you die and the fund takes over and manages the money. I mean, that might be incorporating something in secret, doing something in secret, but that's not what we're dealing with here. But you think you can get away with it with the secret. And I suppose it's a secret fund, if you have any of them left after what has happened in the past 24 hours and people have been running away from them like a pariah politically that he is. And now we can start repeating, can we call them incorporating a company in secret? And putting it in the public register in secret.
Because if things are not this serious, they would actually be funny.
And then you say, but we've taken advantage of the fact that we're only going to be assisted by the Gibraltar Savings Bank, which we are using to fund our program, is a debt of the bank and not a debt of the government. Taking advantage of it, Mr. Speaker? Where was it during the last election? The whole debate was that people say, look, this issue vote could be, I can get rid of this, I probably get in 5 seconds, I can just make it better to the savings bank. In some measure, they don't accept any of what we said at the time, Mr. Speaker, but in some measure, we just followed the advice of the greatest Gibraltarian of our times, Mr. Speaker. But we must have taken absolute and utter leave of his senses. They have forgotten his senses, Mr. Speaker, or left his brain behind a spark, Mr. Speaker. When he said this, the only possible explanation for the huge explosion of Gibraltar Savings Bank advances, where the Gibraltar Savings Bank was paying between 4 and 5% interest, is their interest rate. No credible bank in the world is paying that kind of interest. Those interests are there to attract motivated holders so that the government can use the money for its own expenditure. Mr. Speaker, again, pen engaged before brain and then tongue engaged before thought. But we have happy forgotten that it was, he doesn't like me calling him the backbencher, so I'm going for the other term now. Happy forgotten that it was the man he said was the greatest Gibraltarian of our time, now carefully nuanced, not to offend anyone. The greatest Gibraltarian of our time who fixed the rate at 5%. All we have done, Mr. Speaker, 2 months ago, is lower the rate. And that backs his argument so completely, that it is actually quite incredible that he didn't think that through and not give me this very easy goal to score. But he doesn't do much thinking, Mr. Speaker. Let me just show him exactly what has happened in the savings bank, given that he wasn't here to hear the masterclass given by Mr. Osama Lincoln. Mr. Speaker, it's a real pleasure to hear Mr. Osama when he's in full flow. I will always remember his contribution in the Hiraldi Home Inquiry when he took it twice. But this is what he had to say yesterday when he was out peddling the distortions of the Lloyd's report. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I think Mr. Bettino was very kind yesterday in saying that even though he might not agree with Joe Bettino, he enjoyed his contributions and it said a lot for a man aged 76 to do 2 hours on his feet in this place and having gotten up at 3 o'clock in the morning to write his contribution. And I would say that there's life in the old dog, yes, except of course, Mr. Speaker, there's more life in the old dog than any of us younger dogs. I'm just as happy as ever to hear you say that. And all of them in the same place, all those 13 people. And you said, listen to that. And the Honourable Gentleman would be wise to listen
today's words of the founder of the GSLP, the founding father of the GSLP, the rainy day fund man, the man who says he agrees with and he doesn't agree with me, all of the rest of it. My dear David Dunham, he said this to me. In 1988, I set out to expand the role of the savings bank. It was not an easy task in those days because the Secretary of State had the last word and the Foreign Office had to consult with the Bank of England. The reply from the Bank of England was that the savings bank was supposed to be a small colonial bank, as if it was still 1832, and we should not be allowed to get any bigger. Well, as the leader of the opposition will know, the GSLP government of the 1980s was not the state of government, but took no for an answer. Much better than being in the most authority with a few hangers on. So I used my well-known powers of gentle persuasion, I've yet to come across those, but the gentle part of this, and they finally agreed to let me get on with the job of making it profitable on a growing institution. And that just sets out the history in financial terms of the bank. We inherited in 1988 a savings bank with a £2.6 million deposit. 2.672.384 exactly, and 89 cents to be exact. The profits for the financial year 1978 were 60,107. The profit for the year was retained by us and added to the reserves, increasing them to a level of 398,227. In our 8 years, we increased the deposits, profits, and reserves. In other words, we did then what we are doing now. By March 1996, deposits had grown from 2.6 million to 179 million, a 6,750% increase. In case people think they have misheard, it's a 6,750% increase. On this level of deposits, we made a profit of £4,705,698 in 1 year, compared to the £60,000 in 1 year in 7 years. And we added the profits to reserve and left them there for the GST to spend when they came in the following May. The reserve we inherited in April 1988 had been £398,227, so less than half a million. The reserves that we have seen inherited from us in 1996 were £30,549,249. So the GSLP government increased the reserves from £400,000 to £30.5 million. And then I wanted to say the reserves we inherited from the GSLP in 2011 was £1,446. With the greatest of respect to Mr. Speaker and the fact that many years of inflation have passed, the AACM left £400,000 when they left in 88. The GSLP left £30.5 million when they left in 1996. The GSLP, the party, is so massive that you will never leave it. He left £1,444. What a misplaced of love, Mr. Speaker. So perhaps the members opposite, said Gilbert and Carrie Ann, may forgive me, but I feel I do not have to accept any lecturing from them on prudential management or looking after our people's money. We had the same moment from the opposition between 88 and 96 as we get from the opposition now, Mr. Speaker. The same idiotic arguments about risk and exposure. Clear as ever there, Mr. Speaker. But taken to new heights. If the GSB lends to the government and the government fails to repay, the liability falls to the government. So as guarantor, as much more special, as how much more special an argument can we get? In this case, in case some of the government thinks the GSB lending money to the government is new, it was already happening before 1988, but in a small scale, as the whole of the assets is only a couple of £1 million, before 1988, not before 1996, before 1988, under the AACR. However, by 1996, the GSB was investing in government debentures to the tune of £59.3 million. This time round, however, the critics did not even try to have an element of truth in what they said. For example, the former tax collector, gamekeeper, turned coach, and his wife had the audacity to claim that we had UK experts like him, I suppose, who he said that we deposited in the £1 billion plan providing a risk-free investment at the expense of exposing to their own capital. This, even though I have told the GSP opposition in this Parliament on more than one occasion, that 99% of the deposits are from local sources and not expensive money. Don't listen to the argument that we can have it on a sensible basis. Not that I see anything wrong with accepting expensive money, which would be very welcome. Because a political gimmick, this takes the case. Mr. White would stick to advising his clients that he would be threatened with liability. Very wise words indeed, as I understand. The savings bank between 1988 and 1996 is an important part of our economic plan for growth and prosperity. It has been since 2011 and will continue to be in the future. The GSP we inherited in December 2011 had £273 million of deposits and £1,424 of reserves. The results for 214 audited and published last year show deposits at £856 million, 99% from local sources. Note, Mr. White and anybody else. Profits in the year of £8.9 million and reserves of £11 million. For the year ending March 2015, we expect subject to audit around £1 billion in deposits, around £9 million in profits, and around £20 million in reserves. Mr. Speaker, we shall defend our stewardship of the savings bank when the election takes place and will continue to grow its deposits, profits, and reserves when we are returned to government. If I may say so, Mr. Speaker, here we very Bosana here. Vintage Bosana in every way, Mr. Speaker. What a pleasure it is to be able to quote a Jedi Master and his brilliant intervention. But most importantly, Mr. Speaker, a reflection to Mr. Bosina, that it's a very good thing indeed that this particular leopard does not change its spot. Very good for the community, very good for savers in the savings bank, Mr. Speaker, and very good that we can deliver great growth again and again, doing the things that David Hammond has demonstrated that we can be so successful for our community in the past and is doing again. And so, Mr. Speaker, really, for the people, the issue of the savings bank is really now who do you trust? It really is who do you trust? Do you trust Paul Bosana and Albert Menner, the financial secretary with your money, given the track record that Joe in particular has established and the reputation of Albert Menner? Or do you hand over control of this money to Mr. Peter? That is really the litmus test for people. Joe Bosana and Albert Menner, with the track record of Joe Bosana and the reputational integrity of Albert Menner, or the musician and a huge firm about the bank. Who do you trust with your money, Mr. Speaker? That's really the question. I mean, I think that is a no-brainer, Mr. Speaker, even for people without brains, for things even he must go and Mr. Speaker, what's the main accusation on Doe? He says, Mr. Speaker, that the debt in Gibraltar now is larger than ever if we include company debt, which you can't see in the book, but is there by his measure being the amount of the savings bank investment in credit finance by his measure, which we don't agree with. He says that should be put in the book. But because company debt is not government debt, and it never has been government debt. And it wasn't when they were in power, Mr. Speaker, when they were happy to spend for the company, but now they want it to be government debt. So, what I'm going to do now, Mr. Speaker, is to, for one moment, allow myself the horror of putting myself in his brain, in his mind, and accept that company debt is government debt, and even accept another premise which is wrong, which is that what he says is the company debt is the company debt. So I'm going to accept all the four premises of his argument as true. So please don't turn around and say that I accepted any of this. I'm just doing it because I want to demonstrate to members opposite that how wrong they are, even in the case of this particular interpretation. So for one moment, Mr. Speaker, I will put myself in the horror of his brain. Oh, I just need a spark. Well, growth debt, Mr. Speaker, with company debt in 2008, when the Honourable Gentleman started his journey with the GSB in opposition, with his own government, Mr. Speaker, the first time he was elected in 2007. In 2008, Mr. Speaker, when he was in government with what he called the greatest of the country of our time, growth debt with company debt was 17.8% of GDP. At the beginning, Mr. Speaker, they have to understand that there was company debt. The company debt at the time, even of the hospital, Mr. Speaker. That's when they clapped so hard when Mr. Peter talked about his legacy.
he was against it in 2003, he sold it to the other location. Gross debt, including company debt, had grown by 2011-12, their last financial year in office, with him included, enormously, from 17.8% of GDP to 51.2% of GDP. It jumped from 17.8% to 51.2% under one. Now, what has happened since? Assuming all the things that we should not assume, all the things that were wrong in the way that they wanted to calculate this. What has happened since then? The great debt today, Mr. Speaker, including every penny paid as investment in redeemable personal saving credit finance debt, which it is clearly not, but I'm going to do the exercise anyway, is estimated to be 49.2% of GDP. It was 51.2, it was 49.2, 2.5. And that is with every penny of the investment in credit finance was debt of the government, which it is not. The redeemable preference down a whole 2%, even using his nonsense figures. Using the figures he wants to use, it's down. Using about 400 million as debt. But listen to another thing. Even he will accept that the amounts lent by credit finance to third parties are not government debt, because they are lent to third parties, they're somebody else's debt, they're Sanborn that he likes to talk about. That's Sanborn's debt, not the government's debt. So let us take out the amount that we will see in what I like to call the balance sheet, and he doesn't like to call the balance sheet, the credit finance, on the website. That thing which he says we hide, but we put every month on the website, Mr. Speaker. That spending that is the second book that is every month available to him to come and quote it about here, and it is referred to in this book, Mr. Speaker, under the savings bank fund. If we take out that debt, Mr. Speaker, which is third party debt, then gross government debt against GDP is 45.71% of GDP. But if we do a really precise calculation, and we take out of there as well the payment of the commutation, the payment of the commutation, because that's not government debt, clearly, none of it is, but anyway, and we take out the third party debt, then the gross debt, including company debt, assuming that every other penny is company debt, although it's in the pool and not spent as the Honourable Gentleman pretends to do, but assuming all of that erroneously, the gross debt to GDP ratio, Mr. Speaker, is 42.9%. So what they left at 51.2%, Mr. Speaker, we have reduced to 42.9%. What's the problem? Even doing the calculations erroneously as he wants to do them, and using the information in the book and on the website, although this is public, Mr. Speaker. Only he says we are hiding, but which is public, quite unlike the way that he was hiding who had funded his Lloyd's report. So, just to understand it in household terms, Mr. Speaker, what's happening is that we are earning more each year. Our salary as a community is bigger. We used to earn 348 million under them, we earn 559 million next year. At least, Mr. Speaker, the overall income into the household has grown, not just one actor, but all actors together. We used to bring in 1.1 billion, now we bring in 1.8 billion next year. This as a share of income in the household was higher under them, even when including company debt, which should never be included, This Gibraltarian family, Mr. Speaker, is doing very well indeed, and there is no need to pay anything to the claims of illegal debt, debt-stealing breach, or any other nonsense of the sort that he and his disciples talk about. But what is most galling, Mr. Speaker, is that in this respect, as in every other, he doesn't think of the consequences of what he says. He said on television that we had exceeded the legal borrowing limit. He hasn't said it again.
having the tongue again engaged with the wind, and even his advisors have told him that he went too far. And he was still looking forward to that program, he had said. If he was right, and he was able to peddle effectively what he said, and he was able to persuade anybody to cause a run on any bank except the savings bank that you can't run from anywhere, it would mean to speak that what he would have achieved, but he would not be able to pay for the savings. But he would not be able to fund schools. But he would be in crisis. So what would he do? Is that what he wants? He wants to persuade people, institutions, that you were the government of the voters, that were skimped, to use the word here, Mr. Speaker. And therefore, what he's saying is that we should not pay any civil servants, we should not pay any service, we should stop spending. We, Mr. Speaker, inside our civil service money, did exactly that. We stopped spending, and I think we didn't have to spend money. But he's saying we've exceeded the debt limit. We've exceeded the debt limit. If we got the legal issue, every penny has to go to get a tax to that. But look, I tell the civil servants, I see this today, they didn't want me to pay this. But it is thank goodness, Mr. Speaker, not the case in any way or by any measure. And people much more experienced than him, institutions much more understanding than him of these issues, have x-rayed out. Not because they hear any speech to what he said, but because we had a revolving credit facility that had to be renewed. Because we were going to do, and a special interest exercise, and we're going to lead to a huge investment in Gibraltar. And Gibraltar has been expert, Mr. Speaker. And his arguments look at as well, of course. But these people audit that expert just every year, Mr. Speaker. But he doesn't seem to have much regard for the principle of auditor, which is very similar to that in television. And what has happened, Mr. Speaker? The revolving credit facility has been renewed without a problem, and an investment of £1.1 billion into the Middle East is likely to be confirmed very quickly. Banks don't lend £50 million to countries that cannot repay them, or not these days anyway. People don't invest £1.1 billion in economies that are not going to prosper because the public finances of the place are going to crash. He might not like it, but that is the reality of the situation. When independent third parties come and look at what we are doing and what we are saying, they side with us, thank goodness, not with him on this subject, but with him or his very bunch of men. But if you look, there are 2 points there to take. The first is that those are one of the things that sets us apart from them, that when we obtain loans, when you obtain loans, you don't extend them on terms which we do not intend to keep you. In other words, we do not say to banks, we will pay this money back by adding 5% of the cost of utilities every year for the next 20 years, only to have a member of the cabinet that agreed that deal say, how we never intended to do it. And this alone is a secret of paying in a manner which this government will never return away. And then, Mr. Speaker, of course, there is another consequence to what he has said. He has said in this House on a number of occasions that we are skimped. I think the Honourable Minister, he read us, whispered that word to him and he adopted it. Not blaming Mr. Speaker, he was on his feet. He was speaking on his feet. And to summarise the argument, that we are skimped. And on television, he said, the debt has exceeded the legal ceiling. From Speaker, they have no choice now. This book, and I don't think you've even looked at it. This bill is to enable us to spend £500 million more. If he votes yes to this bill, he is recognizing that we're not skimming, because he's giving us license to spend £500 million more. So he sticks by his gun and believes we are skimped and believes we have exceeded the debt limit, he has only one choice, two really. He can abstain and take the coward's way out, or he can vote no and stand by his principles. But what he cannot do without accepting that he has been wrong all along and that we have been right all along is vote yes. And so when he votes yes, because I assume that he will bring the consistency to this debate, which is the only thing that he does, he will do
greater than every argument we have had in respect of public finances. But we are very concerned that we are on the cusp of probably the most divisive and dirty general election campaign that the media has ever seen. The way in which social media actors, supporters of the older gentleman opposite, are behaving on social media, denigrating even the chair of this parliament in ways which I believe are frankly defamatory and potentially even criminal, are frankly unacceptable. And if that is the way that this general election debate is going to continue, I think that we will emerge even stronger winners. Because if there's one thing that Gibraltar does not like, Mr. Speaker, it is a dirty politician, Mr. Speaker. It is a politician who goes into the gutter to try and make an argument, Mr. Speaker, who cannot make a rational political argument to try and persuade people as gently as Joe Biden has made now in the past 43 years, Mr. Speaker. And I counsel everyone in this community, because we are very political, that we should have the debate. It should be harsh and it should be forceful, but it should not descend into the sort of behavior that we're seeing from some of the social media actors. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Bettino has addressed, which I've already described in positive terms. I don't think I should fall into the trap of continuing to eulogize him, otherwise I might be doing his political battle his service, and he might find himself the subject of an assault soon. Talk about tourism and civil service uses expressed by indicated that he has very few concerns about his expenditure survey because that is a finger in the air. Whilst the receipts then come from the sector, it is real cash are continuing to go up. So it would appear that there is something happening there, and either we are about to get much more cash in if we come back and spend more, or actually a lot of tourists come and don't spend anyway, and they will spend what they spend. And we might need to find them what we take from them. What are we going to do in tourism? Should the heavens fall in and the GOP form government? And we're going to lose 6,000 passengers per pupil every time Carnival Corporation passed the Strait of Gibraltar with one of their fancy ships. But it was actually very refreshing to hear Mr. Speaker, his intervention in respect of our EU office commitment and the work that Sir Graham Watson is doing, the fantastic work that he's doing with the people from Gibraltar who are there with him, learning from him about the institutions. And I think that is going to be worth it. As everything that the Deputy Chief Minister does is conscientiously done and delivered in the long term interest of the community. The Honourable Deputy Chief Minister always has to remember that lobbying is a long term journey ambition, and that you don't immediately see a return, but you do many years from now. If somebody who started to talk to Sir Graham Watson over a decade ago and has turned him into a real champion of Gibraltar, I think he's demonstrated how right he is about that and what a fantastic job he does when it comes to the really good things. Mr. Speaker, he was very, very kind about Sir Graham Watson and the office in the EU, but he was concerned about cost of living. I think we all agree that we want things done, but they cost money. I mean, if you want to get to represent the and at least star representative in Brussels, and we've gone for the A-star. And he was very kind also in his remarks about the Minister for Equality and Tourism and the work that he is doing, and I'm grateful for that because he puts in a huge amount of effort, as do all members in this side of the House. And although he has disagreed vehemently with some of what he has done and some of what he has done, in particular in the field of equality, it is absolutely to his credit that despite those continued disagreements, which is what politics is about and life is about, he recognizes the work that we are all doing on this side of the House, and I want to thank him for it. Mr. Speaker, the Ripley Festival, which we thought was a fantastic thing, was created by us. And we're very happy to have done that, and we're very proud to have done that. But the Speaker, Callum Cooper, was created by them, and it was a very good thing too.
And we have continued it and improved it, and I think, and I'm not saying improved it to claim any credit, they might have improved it if they had been in the government. And I think festivals like that, a food festival, a literary festival, also a music festival, a jazz festival, all of those things are the sort of thing that I think we all agree, certainly those of us who are capable of agreeing across the floor of the House, are exactly the sort of thing we need to do in order to promote Gibraltar as a place where youth tourism can prosper. Mr. Speaker, I think will allow me this moment to praise also Stephen Rice for the work that he has done. Gibraltar does not often have a government which can announce that it has opened two new art galleries in the space of under a year. This is Maria Sillington National Gallery of Art and the Gibraltar Exhibition of Modern Art, the GEMA, and this is with the credit of Stephen Rice. That has been achieved. Stephen is a real driver of the ministry that I have charged him with, and he is tireless in pursuing the objectives of this government. And in particular, Mr. Speaker, having just done that, he has also delivered a fabulous jazz festival every year, which people are enjoying more and more, and becoming more and more popular, and he has delivered something that I think people could never have imagined would be as fantastic as it is. This is the greatest music festival with faith and strength to strength. I'm sorry that President Ganesha is not in the house. I think he's left. He was a certain year ago with the current Peter achievement. I lament the fact that we haven't yet had Mo Williams for the Gibraltar Music Festival. But I'm very happy as an 80s man to have heard Tony Hadley singing in Gibraltar and to see him here standing the Bonham Lagan with Duran Duran on Saturday night. And there is everything for every taste, for every generation. I think the only person who does nothing for the Gibraltar Music Festival is the leading counsel to my left, who is busy working on his legal brief that Saturday night. Today, now that Saturday and Sunday night, what seemed a dream only 4 years ago is now actually a two-day festival. Now, it's popular to denigrate Joe Bassano, but you look at what he does, and actually there's very little ground for really criticizing him because he has produced results like never before. It may be popular to denigrate others, it may be popular to denigrate Stephen Rice. He has delivered art galleries and now festivals like no other minister of culture as before, and he deserves recognition for that, and I'm grateful to him because he's given the opportunity of doing so in his kind remarks about the Ricky Festival. Something which, of course, Neil Costa, with his energy and enthusiasm, was the and intelligence, was one of the prime movers of, I think, what Neil has achieved in that respect. I think that all the things he's done in the time that he has been a minister and living since 2011. And that is one thing that the minute it happened, became a failure. The minute we had our first literary festival, everybody said, we're not letting go of this. People across the partisan divide, people who don't care about politics, people who just love their books and love Gibraltar and love literature, suddenly said, we are not going to let anyone get away with not having a literary festival now as an annual event. And that is a huge credit to the way that the literary festival was organized in the first year. It immediately became a feature of our lives. That's the way to do government. I usually banish them for dinner because of Mr. Speaker, it's the story of the family and the family life. Mr. Speaker, it was Anna's take to the end of the again, in the same way that he relates to government, his way is the way to the opposition. And it was a pleasure to hear him and to take the point I'm taking now. Mr. Speaker, we believe in strong growth in the report. The number of six coming in 2012, which is the year which we inherited to be booked in 2011, was 172. And he likes to look at the number of cruise calls rather than the number of passengers. And by 2015, it was 212. So he can judge us against the other fear. But obviously the fairer thing, including that he's a fair man and I'm giving him the credit for it, is to judge us against our last year. In other words, what we took over and how we're doing it, and that is grown by 2012. And of course, the size of the increase is not just be measured in the number of calls, but in the number of ships. Because in the same way, these magnificent new LNG ships are going to bring in 6,000 passengers. Already they're bringing in a larger ship, bringing in 4,000 passengers. and the number of passengers in 2012, the number that they left up, is 290,395. Already, the joint efforts of the member of the Lorenzo and New Hospital in the field of the new minister, 302,697. Of course, we all want more. Of course, we all want to generate a higher score. Might have been, I don't know whether that was under the GSP or the JSP or the OCR. We want to be higher than the highest there ever was. And that's where we're going, but I think we're demonstrating the trajectory in this case. The only thing that he said, which is a slightly snide reference, is the new company that number 6 in Canada. And I fear, Mr. Speaker, the longer I see him sitting there, the more he is likely to catch an infection, although he's done very well to avoid it. The infection that there is such a thing as a secret company, nothing from Canada, nothing secret, Mr. Speaker. But actually, the work that is done very, very well indeed, Mr. Speaker, because if you look at the numbers of companies, then the fact that they're up is a good thing, and he seems to be against the numbers being up. The more economic actors there are, the more revenue there will be. And the fact that there are more economic actors by way of companies in the construction industry is a good thing. The fact that there are more people employed by them is a good thing. And this demonstrates that this startup scheme, you might not like how we referred to it, actually works very well indeed. I forgot to take a point that you had asked me to take in my replies to people who could explain to me why revenues were estimated to be down from 300,000 to 60,000 in respect of the Russian subsidy. And I can tell him that the information I have from the office of the minister is that because in 1 year, 2 years of revenue were put together for some reason, and in this year, we're not just putting 1 year, but in half a year because revenue comes in over years, but the better way to do it is to put in the rest of the revenue. He said that it like, must be time to the saint, if you use that word, you might not feel comfortable using it, the saint delivering an economic miracle. But I don't pretend to believe that he said I should recognize the contribution of the GOP in that respect. Of course I didn't, because he was here for what I think might have been a fairly slightly forcing remark that I made in respect to the people's political remark. And I said that we were building on 16 years of GOP government and we were not demonstrating what had been done. But we disagreed with a lot of it, and we had done things in different ways, but of course we were building on it. Now, when you look at the economic position in the Tacoma, you're looking at usable cash reserve, you're looking at the banks, you're looking at community care, that was the position then. Look, the economy is running. The economy has grown to 1.1 billion. I'm not pretending I've created an economy that next year is going to be at 1.8 billion. All I am saying is, and not claiming the credit for myself, as I said earlier, I happen to be the person who makes the announcement, who has the reins, but not responsible, therefore, for everything with the 10 others, but delivered the growth in the economy to 1.8 million, but from 1.1. So I give full credit for the growth between 96 and 2011 to the honourable members who were here, but not because they delivered it, but because they were the ones in charge then of the economy that delivered it, and everyone in it that delivered it, but he's absolutely right. I'm not pretending that he started an economy on the 9th of December 2011. Well, he did start to replenish the pot, and that's the step, but the data is there, it's not our data, it's data from independent civil services and most of the finance and the treasury that demonstrates the size of the pot today. And he will allow me to say, I do not believe that that is a miracle. I believe it is just the fruit of management in the way that we have done it. And the Honourable Minister of Finance intervention yesterday demonstrated that the growth had been in particular in respect of the savings bank. He doesn't like the future job strategies, too. But it's a strategy also that he has put up of work in terms of getting people into work. Those people are now people with real jobs, they have real dignity, and they're making a real wage, which is paid at the minimum wage, at least, Mr. Speaker, for some of them, if there's money. So, Mr. Speaker, you know, when he says that they want to do all these things that they want to do, they want to grow tourism, and they want to grow the port, all I would say to him, Mr. Speaker, is if he wants that, if he really wants the port to grow in bunkering, if he really wants the port to grow in cruise trade, if he wants the port to grow in passenger numbers, given the state of position of his leader, not allowing LNG bunkering, not allowing cruise ships with LNG on them, etc., to call the port. I mean, I invite him formally now to cross the system. And he will be very welcome on the side of the house.
because of the objectives that he has set out, which are common objectives to people here. I might offer him the hand of friendship that he's always brought up in political terms also, and to come over, he will be a very worthy member of this parliament. Mr. Speaker, he reflected on how difficult it is to be in this house, not just for ministers, but for everyone in Ghana, particularly for somebody who's a partner in a law firm, and I know that because I've been a partner in a law firm at a time when this house was not as structured as it is now, and when you didn't know when you had to be here, and you didn't know at what time you might adjourn to, and you couldn't fix meetings. But I will put it to him, Mr. Speaker, because we have been political nerds together since 1980. But actually, there is one thing that he failed to reflect, which is actually harder, and I'm sure that he will agree with me. That it is harder to be a good husband and a good father. And I will say that to you. Then, Mr. Speaker, he expressed his own views of what he himself needs as a Peter Cavanaugh to continue in politics for four more years in 2011. Well, I was very generous, I think, with Peter Cavanaugh yesterday, but if anybody had asked me on the 8th of December 2011 whether I thought he would stay around for another 4 years, what as we were from those days of Peter, nothing could have been further from my mind. And now that we have persuaded him of so much else, he didn't say it, but I detected in them, Peter, that he believed that we still done a very bad job, actually, and that there was no need for Peter to stick around, and that he was seeing numbers that were not so bad. And he told us about how he'd been persuaded by leading council, leading council, on the issue of Brussels many years ago, and how he never thought that Sir Peter would become chief minister. But it was generous of him to say so, and I think we have all been very generous in the way that we have dealt with Peter's intervention yesterday. But look, there is one thing that I still would not be able to accept, and that is that in a referendum in Gibraltar, a Gibraltar chief minister might recommend an endorsement solution. And I think that's another reason why the Honourable Gentleman might come to think again and realise that there's room for 11 on this side of the House, for the other side. Especially given the way that he was abandoned by his peers yesterday, because there was more tumbleweed on the other side than there were members of the opposition to hear him, and yet all of us almost were out here. And if you believe Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bassina guys, Mr. Bassina guys, there was no leader, there was no Peter Drama, you know. Mr. Speaker, and the biscuits on some occasions, you all remember we landed with the biscuits on some occasions, obviously got the better of temptation because he wasn't here for the whole thing. I sat through the whole meeting thing. Mr. Speaker, he says rightly, Mr. Speaker, absolutely rightly, that debating issues and not insights would be the way to do things. Well, Mr. Speaker, I consider I'm somebody who deals with appropriate force with the attack put on me. And if you look at my opening speech, you will find that there are no insights in it. If you look at the speech that I am responding to in terms of his dear leader, he needs to understand that the insights that originate in this marriage are bad. And Speaker, I want to thank Mr. Hayward for his intervention yesterday. I'm sorry that I had to delay him by having to adjourn the House. He was also very generous in complimenting Stephen and others and the work that he has done. This was obviously the last intervention of this Parliament, at least for him. And he was very willing acknowledging the work that we have done. He said that we haven't fulfilled our commitment in relation to instruments and the orchestra, but actually, in the speech just before that, giving a lot of indications how that is going to be dealt with. He's right, absolutely right to say that we have not been able to progress with as much alacrity as we would have wanted in relation to the Theatre Royal project, the new Theatre Royal project, and that is something that we are working on design job, and we'll see the fruit of that. It is not going to be possible in the time left before the general election, short of bringing in an accounting set to have a new theatre, but we are working on that already, and the work is very, very advanced. Mr. Speaker, the publication date for completion of the refurbishment is also something that the Honourable Lady had given just, I think, a few hours before the Honourable Member spoke, so I think he needs to take that into consideration in his speech. He said he's disappointed, Mr. Speaker, because we're not building flats for rental. Well, actually, we are building flats for rental, because we're building flats for rental for the elderly. We recognise it and said that wasn't enough. And
actually, they're not just building Chelsea's White House, they are also building Seamaster Lodge, so there are two sets of homes being built for the elderly for rental. Now, why are we not building other rental blocks? Well, for simple reason, Mr. Speaker. Because by building these apartments, the people who will move into them will release a rental accommodation. So we get 154 rental flats by building 154 rental flats for the elderly. So the elderly will build one bedroom, not one RKD, but one bedroom, kitchen and bathroom, and a sitting room. And for families, we would have to build three bedrooms and four bedrooms and all the rest of it. But we get back very large flats, as you will know. We get back five bedrooms, three bedrooms, four bedroom properties that a single elderly person may be living in now by producing this type of accommodation. So this is Ironman Thursday, and your Mr. Bassina will be pleased to hear this over. I think that one of the things that GSU did in the time of the Young Artist is one of the best innovations and developments is the creation of Disciplinary House, which then led to Albert Christa House. And we are continuing that strategy in building Chelsea Sun House and Seamaster Lodge, and in that way releasing apartments for rental. And anyway, Mr. Speaker, what money would the honourable members like me to spend on rental flats? So they say that I'm doing too much. By refurbishing the existing, how should I build new? If I build new, I'm going to have to refurbish the existing. Another thing that he said, Mr. Speaker, was that the work being done to the existing housing stock, not the refurbishment, which I talked about, he's got the timetable for the completion of those in the other lady's speech, but the work done in each apartment, the complaints used, the housing work over here, that's not working. Well, there's no transparency. Well, that's not true, Mr. Speaker. As the Honourable Joe Bassana indicated, there was a quote, and I think he responded immediately, there was a quote from the Housing Works Agency, then that quote was put out to three quotes from the company that are going to do the work, and there are very many, very many happy clients, Mr. Speaker, and we have broken the back of the backlog. Now, is it always perfect? The Honourable Gentleman needs to know that in building it, nothing is ever likely to be perfect. You do an extension to your home and you're very happy that it's finished, but then you start to snag and you have to fix. And the best builders in the world require modeling, Mr. Speaker. And look, if there are works that are not completed properly, the work of the Honourable Professor, please let us know and we will ensure that we deal with it. In the old days, ministers were not allowed to call and make complaints, the shadow ministers rather. Shadow ministers have less rights than citizens. Today, we know you can pick up the phone and we will deal with an issue that you put forth in terms of a system. But look, if there were, I don't know how many thousands of outstanding complaints, and there are now a handful at any time, well, that's a very good thing. And most of them have been done properly, and there may be some complaints in respect of some, and already George Hannah told us how that is dealt with. Mr. Speaker, he then talked about the criteria for the allocation of affordable homes and said that we were not doing it properly and that there were complaints about it because we were not following the proposal to allow people who sold in England to stay. And he said, look, the people we are following housing this first and foremost, and then the other criteria is public, and it's public at the time. What we are not doing, Mr. Speaker, which honourable members opposite did do, and who accused us of not being very socialist in the way that we do things, what we are not doing is selling four or five bedroom homes to the highest bidder. We are selling four or five bedroom homes to somebody who might require a three bedroom home if by the time we've gone through the housing list and everybody who wants who is entitled to a four or five bedroom has said they don't want to buy, then the three bedroom entitlement is able to see from what it is. But that's how we do it. That is not how it works in the time that honourable members are in office. As you know, the highest bidder won. So if you are prepared to buy 100%, if you are a single person, energetic, enthusiastic, and intelligent, Mr. Speaker, a single person, a barrister, right? Young, free, and single at the time, able to afford a beautiful maisonette on Waterport Terrace with views of the new LNG facility in the country. Four bedroom maisonette, and you have the money to buy 100%, the GOP sold it to you before selling it at 50% to somebody who had a family and six children. And we think that was very appropriate, and we think that was the wrong criteria. So now we sell to the people as entitled, not based on the percentage that they are prepared to buy. Although, good luck to those who do.
in relation to mortgages, I think it's very clear now that actually there's going to be much more mortgages available than are going to be required. People sometimes forget that Barclays is still going to be in the market for mortgages, although it's not in retail banking. I think the mortgage is over £100,000, and therefore anybody who's buying 100% of a property is going to be able to go, even in the sector of affordable homes, to Barclays, as I understand it. Mr. Speaker, he was extraordinarily kind to the Honourable Minister for Equality in the work that he does internationally with him and others when they travel to Timor Parliamentary Association meetings. There's one thing that has always united the House, is the work that we do in the Timor Parliamentary Association. The clerk of the House is very helpful in organising those events, and the special clerk has worked very hard indeed. It's one of the bits of the work of the House that we forget about, and I remember enjoying it, in part because of the spirit of camaraderie that we take out there together, where party political affiliation is forgotten and Gibraltar always comes first. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for the words that you used about Samantha Sacramento and the work that she has done there. She was, Mr. Speaker, when first elected to the House on the 9th of December 2011, the person who had no parliamentary experience, and the way she has discharged the conduct of her responsibilities in the time that she has been here has demonstrated her huge ability and the victory of the family, and doesn't like to be carried, and demonstrated why it is that she has brought such value to this community and delivered so much in such a short time. Mr. Speaker, I want to thank him also for the work that he and colleagues in his side of the House do in respect of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association in the UK. It's an important step that we will do for Gibraltar. Recently, Joseph Banner showed how it can be harnessed to make important points about the rights of all the other societies to be represented in Commonwealth of the Government meetings when those happen. Mr. Speaker, then he didn't talk about the issue of allocation of housing, which is the recent copies by a member of the UK, because he realises that there's a main point there, and the Minister allocates housing as the allocating authority under the law that they created. The 155 allocated, most of them are on advice, not all of them, telling her to put to your child here and move people here, etc. But what was telling is the speech from one of the ladies that she indicated, in fact, that 490 direct allocations have been made around the numbers when they were in government, not 190, but 155. 490 on one occasion. I think it was 1 week actually, and it was just before the 2007 general election or the 2003 general election, I forget, for flats at Mid-Harvey, a flat that didn't exist, and I got the feeling that we were actually intelligently reminded. And all of those allocations were made not even, Mr. Speaker, not by the housing allocation committee, not by the housing minister. They were made by the chief minister, the number six from the places where the speaker yesterday usually reminded us. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Pereira with an intervention, which I am going to deal with now. Now, I want to start with a little bit of reflection. Some years ago, when we were in this House debating, I called him our erstwhile friend, and he said that we're in the debate. And I'm very pleased to see that we are no longer erstwhile. We are now also, once again, friends. But he said, Mr. Speaker, that having meetings in public at the BBC doesn't mean that it's any more open or transparent or accountable, because the group cannot vote out the BBC over the government. Well, that would be, if you have those thoughts, they are so far away from the types of thoughts that the GOP used to have in office, which is that they were opposed to the BBC. They held the meetings behind closed doors, but look, there's room for a little one here if he wants to come over too. Because we believe in more democracy, but we don't believe in it. Appointments being made to DCC by general public vote, we are about 4 times if I see the ballot. I don't even want to do something, we appoint the DCC. But actually, we don't support the DCC, they're very, very expensive. The House supports the DCC, and we vote for the DCC by closing the legislature on behalf of the public. And the town planner and all the other people who have this is with the office, not the planner, then are put there by public voters of the people. Speaker, Trevor was no problem with investing into both of the first two core homes, which I thought was actually very telling, and I agree with him. I think right in the face of what you have heard from the leader of the opposition, and he's keen to see the private minister taking the wheel of the growth in our economy, which I agree with, and I indicated in my opening speech I think is what is happening, and that the only dark cloud that we see is credit finance. Well, as we have seen, I think, in the course of the debate, credit finance is no dark cloud. The savings bank has been stronger than ever. But the speaker, the one thing that he talked about, I'm going to be talking and anything like that, but the one thing he talked about is that the cost of the modern economy is reports. And I put it to him, he got that wrong, the speaker. And then he added all of the cases for the financial year 12, 13, 13, 14, and 14, 15 to reach the sum of 838 million odds, which he talked about, 829 million. Actually, 586 million of that is made up in a different way. Part of it is traffic times, which is 60,000. The fees of the consultants are 380,000. And the purchase of speed waivers and speed and curators, the cameras, which are coming to him, 140,000 pounds. So it's not quite like the honourable gentleman's fifth. The speaker, the one thing on which he and I and the government and the team have a big difference is the issue of the Mahathir case. On the 7th of February 2012, Benjamin Mahathir and Solomon Mahathir presented a constitutional motion to the Supreme Court seeking their discharge as defendants in the case of discriminatory intervention. The motion was based on three grounds. One, that the legal aid fees and expenses rules of 1981 were out of order. Two, that the legal aid fees and expenses rules of 1981 were unconstitutional in that inter alia the rates were so low that criminal defendants were precluded from effective representation. And three, that the claimant's rights under Section 8, 2, C, and C of the Constitution, the right to be provided fair legal representation at public expense, where the interest of justice so required, that's what the Constitution says, had been violated in that they had not been provided the legal representation in circumstances where the interest of justice plainly so required, and where they had been and remained unable to do so through impecuniosity themselves, if you feel it. James Meek, Mr. Speaker, of CI's family of the Mint, was asked to advise on the likelihood of success of the constitutional motion. His advice is clear and categorical. On the 2nd of March 2030, advised the following, and I am going to reveal this advice to the Speaker, conscious of the fact that the government is not obliged to reveal the legal advice that it received. He said this to the Speaker. I consider that the motion that I've just written is likely to be successful. Alternatively, the grounds relied upon in the motion are likely to constitute good grounds for appeal. Mr. Reese is also provided with a copy of a draft legal aid bill which had been prepared by the previous administration, the one he often refers to, Mr. Speaker, specifically by the leader of the opposition and he was Minister for Justice. This is the bill which the opposition has been criticized for not introducing. Mr. Reese did not advise whether the position would be different if changes were introduced to the legal aid scheme with improved rates as set out in Schedule 4 of the bill of the draft bill provided to him with the Honourable the Leader of the Education Claims Credit and the draft of the Minister for Justice. Mr. Reese QC advised as follows. I do not consider that the proposed new rates are likely to secure effective representation unless a competent practitioner can be persuaded to act at those rates. New rules were published in March 2012 which allowed Mr. Mahathir to secure effective representation which allowed them to be tried on charges of serious fraud. They were subsequently convicted and sentenced to 11 years and 7 years imprisonment respectively. Had we done what the opposition had been urging us to do, it is likely that advice by the team that they would have been discharged and would not have been tried at all. We acted responsibly therefore, Mr. Speaker, and in the public interest. The voting reputation as a financial services centre is too important for us to risk by allowing people who acted criminally because they have been found guilty to get away with it as a family estate in that meeting. And really, Mr. Speaker, what could possibly have been our alternative interest in funding their legal aid and not the legal aid of others? Can members of the explain to us why they think we may have done this for the Mahathir brothers and not for others? And I do think, Mr. Speaker, that they're not allowing rumour and innuendo to fuel even their most exotic fantasies. Why would we want to spend money on legal aid that we didn't have to spend if we were not advised by an eminent leading counsel not to spend? Dr. James Smith, you see, James Smith, you see, that he's had to do it. If they have a different allegation to make, they should make it, Mr. Speaker. Or else, Mr. Speaker, the real evidence is that if they had been in government, they would have had to do it too. And Mr. Speaker, if the law developed by them failed this advice of the state, it couldn't be implemented, and therefore we have to act immediately. Mr. Speaker, I pray to deal now with the Honourable Mr. Medley's answer. Mr. Speaker, let me start by saying that Mr. Medley did not say a word about it. I understand he's not supposed to say it. But it is not an apology, I think he's supposed to say it. But let me just take the point, let me take the point on this, whether it was Mr. Medley's answer or Mr. Medley's. But we haven't heard a word from members of the group about it. I think that demonstrates how healthy the Gibraltar Health Authority is. Mr. Speaker, there was a lot to say about the Gibraltar Health Authority 3.5 years ago, but nothing now, Mr. Speaker. And I think that demonstrates that of all the people who have been Minister for Health, and there have been many good ones, and all of them, of course, with the right aim to ensure that our community has the best possible health care, you have achieved as much in as little time as John Cooper. Not for good reason, to be Dr. John Cooper, Mr. Speaker. It is not just the Barbary Party that superstitious that benefits from his expertise, Mr. Speaker, but every upright mammal walking this country of ours, Mr. Speaker, and he has done an excellent job. And it is a pity, Mr. Speaker, a real pity, that during the course of this public debate and the way that the news is taken over by this public debate, we have not seen the prominence given to the introduction yesterday, I believe, of electronic notes in the Gibraltar Health Service at last, which, by the way, is compliant with another, say, manifesto commitment, but a huge step forward for our community and something of absolutely huge importance. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Medley, and I'm not going to say more about Mr. Medley in respect to the work he's done in health and utilities and all the rest of it, because a lot of the work he's done with me and other work we've uncovered about SPARC, etc., has been uncovered together. But the Honourable Mr. Medley talks about it. Should also be made by Nana Republic. I don't know whether he realized what he said, because in a banana republic, Mr. Speaker, we would not have had the problems we've had with SPARC and with the report, Mr. Speaker. Things would have been dealt with in quite a different manner. We would never have got to this sort of headline, Mr. Speaker, in a banana republic. And we need to understand that this is what we picked up, and when we say things, we have to be careful how we say them and why we justify them. I showed them, Mr. Speaker. Just how much to say that they have all the numbers they need there in the book. There is nothing hidden and no reason to call anyone in this place a person who is in charge of a banana republic. But if there were a reason to call Gibraltar a banana republic, I am going to remind them of it. A banana republic, amongst the many things that require that definition, and it's related, as you know, to things that happened in South America and Caribbean in the 1950s and 60s. A banana republic, Mr. Speaker, is a country that goes to a lending institution and secures a loan on one premise, fully intending not to comply with the criteria for lending. In other words, a country that goes to a bank, for example, the Royal Bank of Scotland, and ask them for a loan for a power station, for example, and tells them in their business plan that the way that they're going to repay is by raising electricity charges by 5% a year. And signs in with a loan and secures that financing, as we were told was the case, as we were told that the contract was signed, the financing was secured. And then a minister in that government says publicly that they have no intention of complying with their obligation in the country. That's a banana republic, Mr. Speaker. Now, he will be very happy to know that after the 9th of December 2011, having washed him away from office, we no longer secure borrowing in that way. But I'm very grateful that he was honest enough, as he always is, Mr. Speaker, to go on television and tell the truth. He
for a good reason, vomits his brains every time somebody puts a microphone in front of him. And I welcome that because he tells the truth. And he tells the truth in that unquote program, which speaks about having absolutely no intention of government, of complying with our own obligation. And then on viewpoint, not a viewpoint, at the piazza, Mr. Speaker, drunk on quality, he told us the truth about progress in Gibraltar, on issues of social justice, and equality in the time that we have been in power, the time that we were in power. Now, Mr. Speaker, this is tuna season. And tuna season is a time when the people go out big game fishing. And they see the fish with its hook caught in its mouth, struggling to get it off. Today we've seen such tissue on the speaker. We're seeing the honorable leader of the opposition, wriggling like no one, but caught on the hook. And Mr. Speaker, what we saw yesterday when the other member spoke, and he had to spend about 15 minutes trying to get himself out of the tooth that he had spoken at the bottom of the piazza, and he told us how much progress had been made on the progressive issues, was the other tuna, Mr. Speaker. Skipjack tuna, in fact, Mr. Speaker. But he wasn't getting out of it, Mr. Speaker. It was very clear, Mr. Speaker, that he had said what was true downstairs, Mr. Speaker, and was trying to say something which was not true in the course of his intention. Yeah, I know the government doesn't matter, Mr. Speaker, and nobody thinks of saying anybody otherwise, however much the Arbitrary might try and do so. The fact that the GSFE didn't train women for the servants, and therefore they had to start with something that we went on about, and how they were bad for equality and trying to justify the position. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, I don't expect that. I don't expect that. But let's take a look at Mr. Messina's book. If that was true in 1996, it must have been true in 1988 also. Because we didn't find any women promoted before 88 who were the only women, so there were no women. And why is it, Mr. Speaker, that he doesn't say Gibraltar had not yet started the process of training women and the able to change and people were trying to get married, etc.? He says all beforehand that the SFP hadn't done it, which we don't accept. But why did he say Gibraltar didn't do it? Why did he say the OCR and the WBT didn't do it? Why? Because obviously, Mr. Speaker, he doesn't want to have political issues with others in his executive. He wants to pretend that the world started in 1988 and that then the New Testament started on 1996, and he's going to do things the way Mr. Messina suggested that we should, and give credit backwards, and must also understand that there are problems backwards. So if there was a problem in 1996, there must also have been a problem in 1988, and I'm making no comment about that, Mr. Speaker, but I'm just asking the honourable gentleman to reckon with that. Because the other gentleman talked about the climate situation. He said there was an elephant in the room. The elephant has been exposed today, right? But climate, Mr. Speaker, is a good man. He's somebody who is going now with our best wishes. But he can't talk about climate situations and issues like this seriously. These are two serious initiatives, Mr. Speaker, for somebody to be pretending that we can go from North Mole back to Lastly, that Lastly would have been ready, that the ESG is against it. We have been ready at the ESG has said. The ESG has said it's concerned because of the road report before they knew the reality of what was behind the road report. I think the ESG are very responsible, Mr. Speaker, and I said so yesterday in Newsweek. And I think that when they see the reports are available, they're having different views. Mr. Speaker, then he talks about Mr. Bessa. Mr. Speaker, that was never our slogan, but he wanted to make the point because he liked to make political points. He said that the food plant was our failure. Mr. Speaker, we may be a much more advanced in relation to the food plant when they as a world were on the cusp of signing something. He says that we've allowed the Lumia to use the failure of the sewage frontier as the argument for the Western Beach species. Doesn't he remember that the Western Beach species problem started under them, Mr. Speaker? And doesn't he know, because he doesn't follow it, that the European Commission, Mr. Speaker, has recently accepted that the Gibraltar issue, the Gibraltar problem with the sewage plant, which is leading to a pilot case, which we hope to stop because we'll grant the contract, is not the issue that creates the problem on Western Beach. I think he's only following part of the debate. But you think that he has been on, he's been an advocate for the rights of Moroccan families, and I recognize that and praise him for it. But he cannot pretend, Mr. Speaker, that the problems of the Moroccans started again under the GSOP, because before 1988, those
the same problem. And people were deported not to have children here. So it was even worse for the Syrian authorities. Exactly. Deported from them. And so there were a lot of Moroccans in Gibraltar who have not been recognized nationality under the OACR. There were a lot of Moroccans who had their lot improved after 1988. There was more to go. You did some work in it in government, as a party when you were in government, not work that we thought was the best way to do it. But I think you may just recognize that we have done a lot of work and we have broken the back of the problem. And there are now, we now know a backlog of applications for British nationality by Moroccan citizens. And I don't know if people whether he represents his party in that, because the ex-chairman of his party was saying that we were wrong to have done it, and is on social media saying that the Gibraltar is too small and we should not have done it. And you know, I'm very proud of the fact that we have done it, and it's a good off the back of, and we have a vision as to what is happening with nationality. And then he went on to say, Mr. Speaker, he went on to talk about the Joanna Nunley case and all of this problem, and say that we have denigrated Charles Parker, the president of the Court of Appeals, and just absolute nonsense, Mr. Speaker. And you were given his valedictory. I'm not going to get into the detail of it, and hope that we rise into the political front. I think, Mr. Speaker, with those things which we may have done, which may have been a positive contribution, and with everybody thinking that, look, at the end of the day, he's a good man with a good heart, he's trying to do the best that he can. But I will tell you one thing before he goes, Mr. Speaker. If I needed to invest the money of savers in the Gibraltar Saving Company, the remaining 600 million that they say we haven't put in credit finance, up to the billion, I would buy shares in Cayman Airport so that they are worth and sell them for what he thinks they are worth. And then we would really make a pile for all the savers. But well done, Mr. Speaker, for spending 60 years of your life in the space of 20 years and 20. And a little bit of even just about everything got to be for the future of the personal life. Mr. Speaker, one of the things that John Cook does remind us of was our first visit to Clayton Park. It was an absolutely horrible experience. And I'm very pleased that we are now open to open views and that we are soon be opening other facilities there for dementia and for dementia data. But one of the things that he said which stuck with me, and people sometimes, and they come across in the debate too often, what makes the headlines is the minutia of the argument between leaders. But people don't sometimes realize just how much work is being done by other members of the government. And he said that there are now more operations than ever, there are now less cancer operations than ever, and the work on the point notes, etc., has been done. Especially, I'll give you one thing. The number of operations is certainly up. We've seen more people in the bottom end. Given to what we've heard in the past 48 hours, and I expect it was possible in 3.5 years. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, some of the work that I've done, I do with my long-term political friend, Dr. Joseph Althea. And if there's anybody who understands Dr. Althea's commitment to politics on the other side, then it's Mr. Althea, because we all started together. Honestly, I think at the Rock Hotel when his father was the manager, so we all managed to get together one fateful day there and ended up in a political party, having expected, I think, to go for a drink on a television debate. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, I recognize that Mr. Athena Senior is here today, and I want to echo the words that Mr. Athena Senior had here to say about his commitment to the hotel industry and the fact that he was probably the first of the hotel and appointed to the post of manager of the Rock Hotel all those years ago. But if anybody understands the commitment of Mr. Athena, Dr. Athena, another VP in many ways, and he sought out the problems in my government before they got to me, it is Mr. Athena and me. And sadly, many years that Dr. Athena has been involved in politics, many of them completely unremunerated, not that he's in it for remuneration, and many of them with people not realizing the value that he would bring to the administration of the affairs of our nation if he became the minister. And I think people do now realize that, and the work that he's been internationally, in Europe in particular, and in Washington, I think is really standing through. I think I've said think about something about Paul Delvan and the work that he's done with me on the ID card for both using us here, but I think I think doing the manual intervention, and I think I thank Patricia for the work he's done with the Gibraltar Central Bank and Kilda Recruiter for the fantastic work that I'm sure in the university, in the schools, and the arena, the new Minister of Information, the experience which has been created with Japan, and he's all while continuing to be the best for education among the majority. And through the summer, I was spoken about in such a way in terms that I'm prevailed upon by him not to do so again, whether only in the course of this debate. Mr. Speaker, it wasn't me that said that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition is not of GOP stock, but if you ever needed any evidence of it, you'd see it in this week. What we have offered about is not the GOP anymore. He has single-handedly managed to destroy the back part of the system. It is now, Mr. Speaker, really the nasty party. He complains we have an investment in both sides. Well, haven't we invested already in the two things that most people look to be able to go to 25? But it was them that developed the airport before developing the two new schools that we are developing, before delivering a new 25, before doing any of the things that we did. They delivered an airport and court and a new prison instead of delivering a new base site. Doesn't that conference turn on that? For Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is really exceeding himself in the way that he's conducting his affairs. He knows he's not going to win the election because of his persistent and continuing lack of credibility. So he's doing what those of us know he does in exactly that situation. Firmly, he's not like a rat, he just raises the stakes further and further, double or nothing. On the savings bank, pretending that we're exceeding debt, pretending that there's a balance sheet to lending when actually all of those amounts are in exactly the same balance sheet. On the issue of the liquefied natural gas facility, Mr. Speaker. Well, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Speaker, is a political fraud. He is a political fraud that has been found out from the economy. He is a political fraud that has been found out from public finances, and he is a political fraud, the laws of which I am really going to relish peeling off in coming weeks and months with the public to see how he has tried to corrupt the political process, how he has corrupted this party, and now how he has tried to corrupt this parliament by taking Russian and Gibraltarian money to finance his atrocious campaign of defaming our professionals, undermining the GEA, and undermining the professionalism as well. Mr. Speaker, this is an axis of greed, an axis of cynicism, an axis of conservatives against the British Revolution, ready to do anything to advance the unholy alliance between their commercial and political interests. This is ambition, Mr. Speaker, and steroids, combined, Mr. Speaker, with division. People will want to disassociate themselves, Speaker, politically from him forever after the events of this week. When I was leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker, the previous community in the course of this debate said that I was not fit to govern. That was not for him to say, and it was not for me to say. It was for the public. It was not for this parliament to decide to be in it, and he should take what course for it, Mr. Speaker. That is for the democratic process. I will leave it to people to decide, Mr. Speaker, who would be fit to govern and who becomes the next Chief Minister to vote in, Mr. Speaker. And I trust, Mr. Speaker, that members of the opposition will actually do the right thing in relation to the Lord's report, if only after they have exhausted all other possible options. There are many good people in the GOP, Mr. Speaker. Many of them are telling us that the spirit of the party they joined is dead. They see the party that represents wholesome totalitarian ideas now, Mr. Speaker, as the GSRP which always has, Mr. Speaker. They see today how we represent the older and younger generation's aspirations. We represent hard work, Mr. Speaker, and their old insignia represents opportunism. There are people in the GSRP, Mr. Speaker, who are worried about finances because of things their leader tells them. And they don't want it to be true, even if they don't accept our version of events. And there are those, Mr. Speaker, who are so bloodthirsty for power that they really hope that we are skint so that it might bring down a government, so that we might fail. They don't care that Gibraltar might fail. They don't care that the whole Gibraltar edifice might teeter, just to say that they saved it or rebuilt it. And this is not, Mr. Speaker, what the GSU used to represent. I have never agreed with them, Mr. Speaker, but this is not what they stood for. At a time in our history when some people felt that we were wrong, Mr. Speaker, although we did not believe so ourselves, they acted not out of ambition, but out of genuine concern for our community, wrong that we believe they were. However ill-founded they were then, Mr. Speaker, the party of Peter and Belisle and the party of Peter and Rana is not the party that we see out of this house today, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, for all the reasons that I've indicated already, it is clear that the honourable members are going to be honest to the things that they have said during the course of the debate so far in and out of this House in the past 3.5 years. They must vote against the bill or they are voting to allow us to spend another £500 million. We have governed for all of the Gibraltar, Speaker, in the past 3.5 years, and if we are elected again after this election, we will do so again, without discrimination based on partisan support. Everyone who brings something good for Gibraltar, we will work with, Mr. Speaker, and we have demonstrated that. All talent will be harnessed for the good of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. With my colleague, Mr. Speaker, who was a member of the Executive Committee of the GSU and who now is a private practice and real estate agent, wrote in the introduction to one of his business magazines, the March edition of this year, the following. I really wish I could tell you something different and throw caution out there, express concerns, etc., but I just can't. It's simply not the case. Mr. Magaluffo should be thanked for his honesty. The reality is that none of the issues that they are raising, none of the issues that the leader of the opposition, rather, I should say, is raising, cause real concern to those who understand the issue, Mr. Speaker. The mission we decided to accept when we became the government of Gibraltar was, it was said by members of it, impossible. They said it was absolutely impossible and we had embarked on a mission impossible. But with true Gibraltarian grit, Mr. Speaker, with hard work and with the intervention of members of the government and my side of the House and the hard-working people in our economy, impossible is nothing, Mr. Speaker. Today, Mr. Speaker, I can proudly boast for my colleagues and on behalf of my government that what we both said was impossible is today a mission accomplished in many areas, Mr. Speaker. Rounding up now, Mr. Speaker, with the Gibraltar that we inherited in 2011 is one of a golden legacy of undisclosed loans to developers, £4 million lent to ARM, of legal actions, Mr. Speaker, coming out of our ears, leaving Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, with only £2 million of usable cash reserves. How dare any member opposite raise the specter of bankruptcy or an illegal debt ceiling, as honourable members, as well as the leader of the opposition, has done? The specter of bankruptcy, Mr. Speaker, is sitting on the benches opposite. They were the ones who were going to come here to raise the debt limit or not be able to pay for what they were doing. This is a rotten legacy of legal claims, Mr. Speaker. We've won against AHL, but we still have the rest of the case to go on. But in any event, if when you win cases which relate to the time that they were in office, it's because they did things well when they were in office, then they should at least recognize they won the harbor of new litigation because we have done things right when we were in office, something that they have never done. But I want to drop my hat to members opposite for a particular reason. They are garnering support. It is true that they are garnering support. We should not pretend otherwise. Because the other leader of the opposition has gathered unto himself all the disaffected who want and who didn't get an insistence. All those who wanted something they did not deserve and did not get it because they didn't deserve it are flocking to him. All those who were giving feedback about the reasons why they didn't get a job, which shows they didn't get it because they did not deserve it and they were not sent for the job, all are flocking to him now. All those who couldn't accept the truth about their own act of failure and wanted jobs and promotions they did not deserve. All of those, Mr. Speaker, and I see are close to the GSC and the Honourable Gentleman. Because even those who wanted and expected a bloodbath after the election and their blood thirst was not satisfied, they're flocking to him. Because Mr. Speaker, he has gathered unto himself with the clarion call of an end to the culture of entitlement everyone who believes that they're entitled to something and didn't get it. That's what he's playing on his feet as the type of collective belief that he is doing to the political oblivion to which they are confining themselves. But a year, Mr. Speaker, 4 years ago, during the course of this debate, it was said that I was unfit to govern. Mr. Speaker, and they have to say I proved them wrong. 4 years ago, they said I'm unfit not to deliver. How we prove them wrong? 4 years ago, they said that they would win the election. The general public proved them wrong. Mr. Speaker, this year will be no different. They're wrong about debt, they're wrong about gas, they're wrong about the savings bank, and we and the public will prove them wrong again. I am pleased, Mr. Speaker, that we have endured the debate that we have had. The demonstration of the party opposite is clearly riven with division, clearly torn apart by competing ambitions and clearly not able to aspire to taking the reins in our great nation's affairs. Mr. Speaker, this is not the GOP team sitting to your left, it is the GOP team, drawn of talent, devoid of credibility, lacking in substance, exposed in force, dangerously ambitious, and politically finished. I have heard nothing that is remotely the type of analysis one might have expected to hear from an alternative government. While he, Mr. Speaker, he said we would change things, and we have. We said we would govern as a team, as a cabinet, and we have. We said we would have parliament monthly, and we have. We said we would lower our debt and grow our economy, and we have. We have done what we said we would. This is the history of our time in government today. That is why we deserve the trust of the Libertarian people. That is why we have earned the trust of the Libertarian people. And Mr. Speaker, I've heard nothing this debate from the few members of the opposition who have turned up and spoken to persuade me that this bill should be anything other and commend it to the House and our community as a whole, so that we can now move on to lay an even stronger foundation for our nation's future. I would move that the House be now recessed until 8 days. I put the question.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to appropriate sums of money for the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2016 and further sums of money to the service of the year ended 31st day of March 2014 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Appropriation Act 2015. Chief Minister?
For the blessed relief of being able to have a lunch, I propose that the House be now recessed until 4:30 this afternoon.
The House will now recess. Thank you. Thank you.